a lot of these items.
Conference record has joined the conference.
The fact that a lot of these items focus on exchanging information and stressing that importance at the point of care, I think is going to be critical in a number of areas. It's going to reduce duplication of services. It's going to mean that physical health and behavioral health services can be appropriately coordinated. It's going to allow, in terms of pharmacy, all of this information that's available at the time, I think is going to maximize the chances of achieving efficient, effective care. And the way to achieve that, obviously, is more challenging, but it was a central piece of this.
So let me see if we can restate this succinctly for Gwen. So that your point, if I get it, is the overarching imperative of having the multiple sets of information integrated and available at the point of care.
Correct.
So that there are a lot of implications for that, but Lori?
I'm nodding.
That's good.
Yeah.
Are you passing?
I'm passing for now. Yeah. Okay. A few thoughts came up with this. First, in the spirit of full disclosure and for a critical eye and looking at the numbers, I will admit that on areas where I felt very strongly about an issue, I did use more than one dot. So, there could be areas we were allowed to do that. So that was very good in terms of the critical eye. But two things that jumped out to me on the glue piece is I would have liked to see more in here in terms of a focus on the social services as well that need to be wrapped in with the glue. I didn't see them coming up there, and I think that in the discussions among the group that was acknowledged that that's a huge piece. It shows up in housing elsewhere, but I would have liked to see that included in as well. And then in going down the list, trying to think of, how would you implement all of the different pieces of the glue, in looking at the screening required with state-of-the-art techniques and technology, that was 22. It was among one of the highest. And I think we need to think about how that would be implemented in terms of how do you make sure the workforce has access to state-of-the-art techniques and technology. How are they trained on this if we're pushing for evidence-based practices and other types of screening pieces. So I think that's something that, from an implementation standpoint, we may want to just look at, because I think it's an important piece of the glue if you're looking to change practice.
That's a very robust comment. Thank you.
It is. You expect nothing less from me, right, Mark?
Phil?
Verbose.
I wanted to, the glue I thought was probably the most important one is the electronic communication, but it's at the system level and it's at the provider level. It's at both, and assuring that the providers have the capacity to do this as well, I think, is important.
So that's sort of a friendly amendment in a sense to what Sanjeev said. It's the information is needed at the point of care, but it's also going to be used at the plan or the integrated system level.
Right.
Gail?
I think that pretty much all the issues are here.
So I was gonna. My next call. So the also as an addendum to what Kelly said around social services, I think that not only do they need coordination between the different social services, but some way needs to be figured savings that more efficient and more developed care in our system saves from other systems, not just Medicaid, because in the end, we're taking out of the same pot and we're eating each other ourselves. So that was that. On the HIT stuff, I'm a little concerned because all of the money up till now has flowed to primary care providers and to hospitals, and not very little to our universe, our CBOs. And it's about readiness for that, and also the RIOs, which are going to presumably at some point help advance our HIT capability, are expensive for the most part. All through Greg, I'm sure, through the SPA amendment, but we need to figure out how we're going to pay for it.
One item that's covered and one that's missing that are important, I think, is consumer empowerment is almost the super glue of holding things. along with that, one that was mentioned down the line that's not here is the social supports that are such an important part.
So there are several. This has come up with several, you know, several people, and that is that the imperative of the non-health stuff. So big, you know, big stuff left to do about that, and big decisions.
I think co-location of services is crucial, along with regulatory relief is crucial for us to move the system along.
Taking the screening issue, but then taking it one step further, because not only were there a lot of points given, I think quite rightly, for screening required with state-of-the-art technology, but also for no wrong door access. How we can make that work, I recommend that we need to develop standardized screening and assessment tools so they can be used across not just our system, substance use disorder, mental health, but also primary care, and also standardized criteria that would be used by the service providers and by the payers.
Somebody's got to mute, please.
Through a lot of these, which is that a lot of these areas are duplicated. And when you consolidate them together, I think some of them really kind of jump out even further, like the duplication of services and the no wrong door access, you know, those kind of jump out as big ones. Certainly the care management and the care coordination kind of jump out. So, you know, as we're going through this exercise and next exercise, as we get down to whittling what the actual principles are, I think we should look at that and figuring a way to kind of collapse them down so that they
right. So this, I'll just jump into this. This is going to be a complicated theme, and we don't have the ability around this table to, you know, to do that, to do all that work without, you know, taking lots and lots and lots of time. So we're going to have to make sure that, so the staff that are listening and recording and so on are going to have to try to come back to us with some integration of this stuff that is true to the spirit of the conversation. So it's a really critical point.
Just want to emphasize the access of clinical information at the point of care. We're Greater New York is exploring this further with OMH in the project where we have access to the Medicaid claims data, and providers are extremely happy with them. If there was a way to blow that thing up rapidly, I think it would have enormous value to the system from a reimbursement perspective, cost savings, and it clearly has clinical significance.
So just a little editorial comment about that. Coming back from that is that a couple of our people were over at DOH today for a presentation on our Psyche system, which is sort of a portal and an enabler of a lot of this kind of stuff with Jason and Dr. Shah and others. So that's not the only solution, but it's one solution that can be helpful.
I think from a systems level, there's things that need to happen to have glue at other levels. So I kind of think that first, if you don't have that, and even though you might have some glue down here, essentially something's got to bind all that glue. So the whole area of accountability, incentivizing the right outcomes, and regulatory changes that support all of that. And obviously collaboration is going to be key at all levels. So I just think that there's some elements, like if you don't have, then everything else that's good glue, whether it's, you know, certainly care coordination that is empowered, it's all going to be necessary. But then the other stuff doesn't work if you don't, like, get to the top-level stuff.
And just two comments. One was that the idea of the electronic information exchange and the idea of clinical information and records being accessed by consumers, that I would hope that the exchange would include consumer access. The other piece was the screening required, that it reaches across all, you know, physical, mental health, and substance abuse.
So I'm pulling together a number of things here that planning comes with good data that is widely shared, consumer-directed planning, that the ultimate data is the goals of the consumer, and that the goals of those consumer lead to measurable outcomes. There's a whole piece on measurable accountability and things like that. So there's a flow that's consumer-directed. I noticed the piece about warm touch. We've talked a lot about outreach and engagement in the role of peers, and I agree with all the concerns in the room around the social aspects, housing, support, employment.
Okay.
I'm struggling with how to say this, and I'm at the risk of getting people annoyed with me. I love the conversation about social supports, housing, all these other things that we all know need to be part of the system eventually. But I'm saying eventually because I keep coming back to what's the task of the MRT. And while you can't do stuff for now without thinking about where you want to be ultimately, and that's all this very rich clinical and programmatic discussion, at some point, maybe not today, but we really have to focus back on what the task is that's been given to us through the MRT process, and it'll come up later when we talk about reinvestment, because the ultimate underpinning of the MRT is really twofold. It's saving, and it's improved accountability system reform and improvement. So we're going to have to cut to the chase at some point and come up with meaningful recommendations which deal with the choices we have to make, some of which are going to be painful, and then get to these other things.
And you interject also this notion of sequencing. There are some some first order things that you have to do, and you're able to pull into that some things that you'd like to do, and there's some things you like to do that you can't do until you do the stuff you have to do.
It's a hierarchy.
You got to have your entree before you have your dessert.
So maybe just following up on that, I mean, if the ultimate goal is that we're going to try to save money and improve care, and we know that the unnecessary hospitalizations have to be reduced, and we're looking at the system, one of the things that strikes me is glue, that as a category, has the highest concentration of very high numbers. As compared to any other category, this clearly is the category of greatest concern to people. And you need a lot of glue when something's broken pretty bad. And so I think in terms of the fix that we're proposing and how we use our glue, I think it has to go exactly, where was just suggested. We have a very strong ability to help reduce expenses and to improve outcomes. And so I think,
So let me try to articulate the point that both of you make, because I think we have to have them down in some fashion. They're both pretty complicated. So, Eileen, your point was that we have some immediate assignments. We also have some long-term goals, and we're going to have to balance. So that there's the notion of balancing or sequencing as it relates to priorities. And that may not be our charge. That may be the charge of the state agencies that have to implement this. But one way or another, that's going to have to take place.
The only friendly amendment that I make is I'm not saying we shouldn't talk about those longer-term goals.
Absolutely.
They have to inform. We don't want to do something today
that
limits our ability tomorrow. We just have to, have a hierarchy of what we do first.
Yep. And then, John, I'm losing your try to say it succinctly.
Right. Well, I'll use an example. The screening brief, the screening and technology. We're talking about ESPERT and screening for depression. If we simply made sure that at every entry point into the healthcare
system. This is a different point that you made.
The system is broken. So this section has the highest concentration of priority points.
So the point is that this section has the most highly rated, glue is really significant.
And number two is a distant number two.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, we clearly want to incentivize quality care, and mental health are not always so good at measuring that well.
And I would just make maybe one more friendly amendment to Eileen's points, which I think are excellent. But we also have to think about what we need to make some choices probably in this group and some hard decisions, but what we say as a group is also a form of communicating priorities and other things too. So I think there are some things in our conversation that probably from last week that probably everyone around the table sort of assumes to be true.
You have to say that. Particularly like the stuff around the social supports in particular, but some other things, but I think we need to say them incredibly robustly.
I agree that.
Because we're communicating to others who don't have the expertise that's around the table.
So, Ann, on this one, you get the last word, because there probably are some more things to say, but we got to keep moving, and we started with Sanjeev.
Well, just in response to a little bit of what Eileen said, I think, into the other group a little bit, so it's a preamble. I think you have to be very careful, though, about one particular social support thing, which is housing. If we're going to be pulling in readmissions, which I saw later on as what you want to kind of save your money on, and if you also want to be able to do the kind of glue that you're talking about, I think that if somebody doesn't have a safe place to live. So, again, I think here there might be an opportunity to actually try to tie some dollars to this, not just say, oh, we hope they will come through on the other side with this because we think it's important. But I think that's one of the glue pieces that is just so embedded in being able to do all the other glue pieces that I think there should be a push to make sure that there's real access to that for the populations we're treating and that the dollars flow that way.
Okay. So let's go on to the next category, which is payment, which is a short category. I'll just say that. Short category. So, Harvey, we'll start with you.
Sure. I see a lot there about sharing savings, reinvestment, paying for services and outcomes, and investing in housing. I would tie them all together just to hope that reinvestment can create some of the most needed resources that will be able to sort of redirect savings, that the state won't take all the savings, and build it into contracts and allow it to go to the things.
Nice.
I would second that comment, but my concern also is the eliminate the fee-for-service to the point of looking at the PROS model that it's already in, and the rates that are not working. So
What's the point?
It's really about making sure if we're not going to go fee-for-service that the rates for group rates or whatever you want to call it is going to be adequate.
Wasn't there something?
The first one, for eliminate the fee-for-service.
Yeah, there was a point somewhere, maybe it's not here, that says the rates have to be adequate.
Number 160.
We're going to push that.
Maybe we're later. Okay. Yeah.
Again, I just think from a system standpoint, it's more like we have to make sure we're incentivizing the right thing through the payment, whatever payment systems we create. So I think that, I mean, I'm all for that investment, certainly for reinvestment, but just I think even at the front end, that we incentivize the right things, not necessarily. I certainly want to share in the savings, but if we don't get the front end right in terms of how what we incentivize, we won't have any savings.
Yeah, my comment looking at this is we really like incentives. You know, sort of everybody likes incentives when it's somebody else's money. You know, so it's easy to like incentives when you're sitting around a conference room table. But then you're going to be 4-10% holdback, so there can be incentives. Do we like incentives that much? Anyway, so. Point well taken about incentives, and it's a, you know, it's a delicate point.
Okay.
I just an observation that looking across these, much of this on the surface and deeper down is across the system, but there are also several things that are going to require us to be looking at specific populations, particularly vulnerable populations, and how to address them. Or specific issues within the system. So just two quick examples. One is on reduced hospital readmission, the need to focus on community, developing community detox and less reliance on more expensive and often unnecessary hospital detox that does not link people to care. And then reduced criminal justice involvement is going to require a linkage with the criminal justice system and making sure that people in the justice system don't get lost. And I would add the juvenile justice system to that as well.
So that fits in a sense. It might be linked to the notion of reinvestment, but you're making the point that you have to pay for some things to not, in order to not, you know, spend money on other things.
Exactly.
Yes.
I would just say ditto to both what Donna and Paul said. And because the payment is so incredibly important, but also you can't have prevention and diversion if you don't have places to prevent and divert people from the expensive services.
I'm not sure that this belongs here, but I don't know really where else for it to go, because I think that there's an assumption that there's consensus on what covered services are in mental health, substance abuse, and primary care, and I'm not sure if that's true.
So I think it's a really good point. My comment about that, it goes back to what I said before about how we're all for this population and that population, but our task is Medicaid. You know, and so that's in a sense an expansion of that thought. So what's in the benefit now is what's in the benefit now. Under managed care, theoretically, you could do some things that are not in the benefit now, but if you're going to do that, there are trade-offs. So the need comes back to Eileen's point in a way, the need for us to be disciplined, a little more explicit about what's in and what's substituted and what's not in. And we have a lot of conversations yet to have, for example, about the housing and social services you know, questions. Now, later, when, what? So, Phil?
I'm going to focus on the performance outcomes. I think that we need to figure out how to incentivize those. And if to answer your question, the 10%, if that was necessary, then I would endorse it.
It was interesting to me, just a comment, that the one bullet that's like that says pay for services and outcomes, which is interesting, not just that, but services and.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Kelly?
Ditto on what Paul had said in terms of recognizing that, you know, we're going to need some investment in the community system at some point in our deliberations here.
I'd just like to point out that under payment, the first bullet, eliminate fee-for-service mentality, I think is my read is that that's different than eliminate fee-for-service completely. It's a mindset and a way of working rather than a way of thinking. And I don't particularly want to see anything thrown out completely in a universe where there's value associated with a continuum of strategies.
So we'll see that a little bit in what Eileen and I, you know, present. In other words, fee-for-service is sometimes used within a managed environment to, you know, to pay for certain things. So it's good clarification.
To underscore some of the early comments is to emphasize that when appropriate, people can transition from a more intensive setting to a less intensive setting, and the fact that payment is often higher in certain settings may direct services in a certain direction that may not necessarily be appropriate, but still occur because of this payment boost that can occur. And I think that we have to create an environment whereby, you know, people get the services according to their needs, as opposed to sort of a regimented fashion whereby people stay for 5 days because that's the way it is. And I think we could create a model that's much more, again, efficient and effective during that.
And just on preventive services, I think that's a complicated question, but I think we need to spend some time thinking about that and what you might want in the benefit that really does prevent bad things from happening rather than just paying for what, after the problems have arisen. So I think it's something we need to talk about.
And I would just say I think that the goals of payment seem pretty common, but the how to get there is very hard, and it hasn't been figured out in any part of the healthcare system, I would argue. And so whatever we recommend, we have to be a little sort of flexible, and the mechanisms for doing it have to be flexible.
So, yeah, so there's going to be a byplay here, as I said before, between some of our conversation and some of the stuff we'll talk about later.
It strikes me how many of these are involved cross systems. And so if you think of this as an example about criminal justice, two things. One is if we're successful in providing mental health and substance use disorder treatment, and that drives down and it produces the desired outcomes in criminal justice, is there some cross-systems payment that can be worked out, is number one. Number two, to what extent do those systems mandate specific kinds of treatment which imposes a burden on the Medicaid system? And to what extent might those mandates, either from drug courts or the criminal justice system, et cetera, be more driven by level of care determinations, as we've discussed earlier. So that tension, I think, is something that we could address that would say, you know, create savings and better outcomes.
Eileen, do you have anything on this one? Okay, so we're doing pretty good. Three more categories to go through. We have the opportunity to move more quickly if we've felt that we have covered something before. I'll just make that observation. So we're on the category of outcomes, patient-consumer outcomes. Harvey, we'll start with you. We'll go this way.
Okay. I appreciated the emphasis on reducing the
disparities and mortality. I'm glad that there's plenty of there that's not just about savings and diversion, because the danger is we'll just try to keep people out of hospital but won't improve quality of life. I'd like to see more detail about that, and I like, and I noticed the piece around decreased forced treatment orders as one of the outcomes of that appears.
That would be a term of art.
That.
The forced treatment thing.
Term of art.
Yeah, we'll talk about that more. So.
So.
Okay. Wait a minute. You get. What do you want Gwen to record about that? What do you want Gwen to record about what you?
The whole thing again?
No, just the synopsis of it.
Synopsis is it's a quality of life really needs to trump decreased recidivism and breaking that out in more detail. And particularly, I just wanted to emphasize the reduction in use of forced treatment as one of the outcomes of a better care system, particularly for disparities.
Real quickly, I want to highlight something in patient outcomes and then as it relates to payment outcomes at the bottom. Prevalence of service use equals prevalence of conditions in the population. And this is another way of saying there are unserved and underserved people out there. We can talk about overservice, but we know there's a chunk of people that are lost. At the same time, if you look at that one, and then you go down the page on payment outcomes, where we talk about reinvestment, and the one on reinvestment has the single highest score of anyone in all of these pages. Those two go together. If we're going to do something about serving the underserved, we need to save money on, quote, the overserved. I know that's not a great term. But we also need to think about this reinvestment question, and that's one that really, really worries me, because I'm not sure that money's going to be there, and that's one of the points we need to struggle with.
Good point. Okay.
I'm just struck by the lack of something under provider outcomes that speaks to, like, a better business environment, that somehow all of this is going to wind up rewarding
the patient outcomes.
Provider outcomes? Don't we
patient
provider outcomes?
Outcomes?
Yeah,
sorry.
Sorry
about that. Okay. Oh, actually, this was my error. I said payment, but we really should be on provider. Let's do outcomes. So we're doing outcomes together. You ignored me. It was a good thing to do.
I'll put them all together. All
yeah. So that we've got provider outcomes and payment outcomes we haven't discussed yet. So we're looking at those.
Patient.
We've already discussed one. The two that we haven't discussed yet are provider outcomes and payment outcomes. So we're talking about the
patient outcomes now.
And provider.
Okay.
I mean, I think
they all go together.
Yeah.
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 You just
got to
read through quickly.
Read these are two short sections, so we can handle this. We can do it. John, if you stop, we can come back. Come back. Yeah. Okay.
Just want to echo what Bobby said. The ultimate outcome is the kind of quality of life that people totally agree with that point. But a really hard thing is finding something, the measurable pieces. So I do think we should, not that we're going to identify them specifically in this group, but we have to figure out a way to find something that's measurable that gets to your things.
And just to add to the quality of life, the physical health is a critical piece of that, as well as the mental health. So I think that there are some measures you can use for that, for outcomes, but that's important.
That's a very good point.
So physical health is key? Sort of my summary, Lori?
ITAC.
Pass.
I'll pass.
I think from a kid's perspective, there has to be something that specifically relates to where kids learn, where children function at home, in school, in the community, and just to sort of say that explicitly, that it wouldn't just be that there was a reduction in symptoms, and but that in fact, we know if a kid was managing in school or at home, and we would want to maintain that.
So there are a couple of points that are sort of like that that didn't really get emphasized strongly enough, like the most integrated setting. For children, the most integrated setting is the setting in which they're most likely to actually learn. We have a bunch of evidence about that. So, Phil?
Yes.
A question for clarification, I think maybe you're the answer. Is patient outcomes synonymous with consumer or client outcomes?
That's a...
My patient sounds like a hospital situation.
Right. Well, we haven't, you know, sort of done a thing here about what language we're going to use. I, not having had that conversation, I would say the answer is yes, although it has a different connotation.
Okay. Well, then my comment is, and it goes back to something that was said in an earlier category, I recognize that we have to prioritize things for it and the way they happen, but I do need to comment that the social supports like recovery coaching, peer support, can do much to increase these outcomes in this section and thereby reduce costs. So putting it at the end of the line may not be advisable.
So I don't know what to make of this because this is awfully complicated, but if we sort of try to integrate that point and the social supports that have come up before with Eileen's point, it sort of illustrates the challenges. We all would like to focus on those things we'd like to see or do more of. We know that we're sort of operating in an environment where if we're going to do more of something, we're going to have to do less or spend less on something else. And we enter into this whole thing knowing that we have to hit certain savings targets before we do that. So the logic of how to, you know, how to prioritize these things is pretty concrete, and it goes to some other questions that we'll talk about a little bit later, like, you know, that, you know, should some of this stuff be, some of this non-Medicaid, non-health stuff be thrown into this, or should it be held out of it? Anyway, so just to make that point.
All right, do we get credit for the decrease in unnecessary hospitalizations? I mean, will we get credit for Medicaid costs that we drive down that are...
Well, it's sort of the generally what I would say is that the hydraulics of this, as I understand them, are likely to be that, you know, sort of first of all, there's likely to be some savings target to meet against, you know, current spend. Or maybe it's just holding things to current spend is a savings target. And then you could sort of say that what's in the benefit, subject to other considerations like access and quality and so on, could potentially be moved around.
Are you talking about within the behavioral health benefit?
Within the behavioral health benefit.
That's what I'm saying.
I'm not done yet. I'm just sort of saying that's the allegedly easy part, although that part is pretty complicated. And then there's another part, which is how about reinvesting stuff that's in the benefit into something that's not now in the benefit? And there are several sets of complexities there. One is that's a significant CMS conversation because spending what used to be Medicaid money on something that isn't traditionally Medicaid is going to raise pretty significant, you know, questions. And then there's also the, you know, the question about whether the, you know, the juvenile justice agency that is achieving savings as a result of the Nurse Family Partnership Program that worked with the mom 20 years ago, you know, I've never been in a conversation yet where they're willing to pass those savings over.
Right.
Or even the prison, the jail, who's got those savings in the next quarter.
Mm-hmm.
So it's awfully technical. And I'm starting to sort of get a little bit off here. But the home run is to say we're talking about the benefit and about managing better within the benefit. And second, we're talking about flexing that benefit after we've hit savings targets to do some modest reinvestment in other things. And that one is probably also, you know, okay to think about as long as we don't get too crazy about it. And then beyond that, it just gets, you know, I'm not opposed to it. It just gets very hard. It gets very hard with CMS, and it gets very hard with those other people that you'd want to, you know. So anyway, that's just like a little context for the conversation. And let me just make one other point. An entire separate conversation is the question of how those other non-Medicaid services might work vis-a-vis the plan. You know, so, and we'll talk about some of this, you know, some of this later. So, for example, should housing be thrown into the plans? Well, that depends on where you sit. And then there are feasibility questions. So this could, we could be doing a straight Medicaid thing, which, by the way, I think is sort of where we're probably going to go because we don't have much time, at least for phase one. And then maybe there's a phase two beyond that. This is just me, you know, sort of thinking out loud. But, you know, probably we are too deep into this and we ought to sort of park it and come back for later.
Just a point of clarification. Like the research we did on what Pennsylvania did, for example, where they reinvested from Medicaid into supportive housing with land citizens, that's allowed, right? That's something we could do in
New York? It's theoretically allowed. I mean, again, given what I said, you know, the first thing is that there's, let's say hypothetically the way this works is we've got Medicaid is spending on the fee-for-service benefit this year. So next year we have to, you know, save $6 or $12 million on that. Then we have to save 30 or 60. And then beyond that, we might have to save more. Although we don't have a, we haven't had a conversation yet about the third year, which is the year we're really planning for. So first, you've got to meet that target. Then the question is, can you move resources from, you know, things that you like to do more of to things that you like to do less of to things you'd like to do more of? So, for example, the one that always comes up is, can we save money on inpatient while still meeting people's needs? And could we reinvest that in increasing access to outpatient? That's the classic place that everybody starts. Well, probably we can do some of that. You know, that's a feasible thing to do. And then the question is, what about taking that savings on inpatient and investing it in housing? Well, that's a conversation with CMS that has to be had. That is, you know, we might want to go there, and they might say, we'll take it. You can't do that, you know. So it might be okay or it might not be okay. So that's just the broad frame for it. So there are parameters of what's – this is going back to Eileen's point. There are parameters of how much it's possible to take on at any one point, how much it's possible to take on in year one when we're changing everything else, and then, you know, year two maybe or year three. So we can have a big, you know, a big appetite at some level, but –
just a clarifying question, because I start with the MRT and I think about the big numbers, right? And I'm guessing that Greg will probably hit on some of this, but I'm thinking about unnecessary hospitalizations. If the mental health system and substance use disorder system can drive millions upon millions of savings, right? It seems to me that it borders on being a waste of our time to think about where we can save a couple of million here or there in the behavioral health benefit. If what we could do instead is to say, okay, we will drive tens and hundreds of millions of dollars of savings, and we can demonstrate it and measure it, it would seem to me that it would be foolish for us to not put forward a strong message to the administration that we'd like to help.
Well, it's, as I said before, it's always more, you know, it's always nicer to think about, you know, spending somebody else's money. But, you know, we probably
– whose money is this that we would be spending? I mean, right. I'm thinking about we're going to be saving money.
You know, to some extent, it's the taxpayers' money, and it's already been taken in savings.
This year.
Okay. This year, right. Yeah, this year, and really right. Next year, too, because we have a two-year deal. So the MRT envisions some savings with respect to preventing readmissions that are already taken.
Right.
You know?
So we're tripling the size of mats instead of quadrupling it. I mean, we've limited ourselves to some degree. And I guess my thought is that what we will do is make recommendations that will take us beyond where we are at this point, that hopefully we'll wind up handing the governor a report which will save him more money. And I guess I'm thinking if we can do that in a way that makes some of the recommendations that we've talked about here, it's a value added. So, again, I just want to understand if we have our hands tied here and we were simply operating within a very small piece of the picture, which would be the behavioral health piece, and my thought is that, and again, I might be misinformed here, that if we can show our benefit of providing more mental health, by let's say just the screening for depression and an expert, et cetera, which would be kind of new services and expand those with the idea in mind that we're going to drive people into lower cost services and create more savings, if that's not a discussion we can have here,
you know, and to come up with the ways to reinvest in some of these services. It doesn't, you know, I guess.
Well, so I think we ought to move on because we're sort of into a, you know, either a loop or a death spiral here. But, you know, sort of I understand your point, but it's got to fit to some extent within this framework that I illustrated. There's our Medicaid, there's all Medicaid. Some savings have already been taken or anticipated. How much is it feasible to do beyond that? What would be our priorities in moving beyond that? And what's the timing that it takes to get from here to there? So we can talk about
making recommendations of the kind that we're talking about.
That wouldn't preclude us. You can always, you know, throw stuff on the wall.
You can always ask for it, as you say.
Right? I think Linda has mentioned that, you know, her interest in having some, like, budget guidance along the way. And I do think there are multiple levels here. They're sort of like what you can convince CMS of, what you can convince the state of, and then what can happen within arguably a plan structure where the plan sort of puts the money where their mouth is, you know, arguably, and decide, you know, they get to sort of make some decisions about what's a worthwhile investment or not. So there's multiple levels of where those budget decisions could get made. And it would be good just to keep us all informed of what the possibilities are, because, you know, there may be things that
to the extent we
know,
can get anybody
your DOB
to,
might believe
right.
and CMS
well,
might not, or vice versa.
It would be nice to do that. But to some extent, the question of whether you can get somebody from budget to have a conversation with you now about a budget 2 years from now, when they haven't had the conversations with CMS yet and they don't know what the projections are, it's a little bit, you know. So we'd like to go there too. But so let's. I think we gotta, you know, gotta stop and move on because we're heavy into discussion. So let's finish going around. I don't know. I can't remember exactly where we ended up on provider and payment outcomes. Where were we?
Okay. I just want to go back to patient outcomes because we kind of went over that real quickly. The higher score was appropriate to treatment of care. I think we need to revisit that. Maybe it's the treatment of care. Geographically, it's not always. There is a continuum of care, and a person is not placed in the right level of care. And added on to that, prescription adherence, it is not uncommon. People go through treatment, do extremely well, become employed, but yet they can't afford their medication, or they lose their Medicaid because they are working. And it becomes a revolving door, especially with special populations. They're on the field for 6 months a year. Then go back to detox and such a system. New York did a pilot, New York City, with transitional Medicaid with the residential clients and the substance abuse group failed years ago, and it worked extremely well, keeping people in treatment but also continuing them on their medication.
So this, I think an amendment, Gwen, to what you said, is continuity of care, including access to treatment when eligibility is lost. Or, you know,
transitional Medicaid for someone that is employed but doesn't have insurance or can't afford the copay.
Right. Because we are going to have an exchange now, and theoretically everybody's going to be in one or the other, and a lot of people are going to be moving back and forth between them. So that's a conversation that exists in the health exchange basket.
Just a quick comment on both patient and provider outcomes. A common force driving through a lot of it, of course, is care coordination, which will underscore the importance of making sure that the substance use and mental health services are in the health homes and in integrated care.
Yes, I just want to reiterate that. And also just to comment, on the patient outcome, it says increased consumer engagement, and it got a zero. I mean, I think it's about speaking. You have to engage recipients, consumers, individuals, in order for any of this to work. So I was surprised to see that got a zero.
I will second Paul's comment about the care coordination, citing that, you know, certainly under patient outcomes and under payment outcomes, we have the decrease in the necessary hospitalizations, reducing readmissions. You know, that's certainly one from the hospital perspective that should be on the provider outcome list. Certainly hospitals more than any want to reduce the unnecessary hospitalizations. But care coordination is going to be key to that, as well as the community supports and what's available. And right now that's currently lacking. So
nothing to add. Just two comments. One is that I think overall there needs to be, when we were talking about consumers who are working, usage of the existing Medicaid programs like the Medicaid buy-in and things like that. I think they're very underutilized, and that could bring people to a place of continued work using that. The other thing I think is that
It talks about measures must be concrete and evidence-based. So if we were to look at the services we provide that are evidence-based, if you're familiar with the evidence, it will cover just about everything in the consumer, the provider, and the payment outcomes. It talks about everything in there. So.
At least that which the researchers have paid attention to. But, yeah. Okay. So the I think we ought to move on to Greg's presentation. And let me just sort of propose how we're going to try to sort of handle this. Is what we're going to try to do is staff are going to try to take the conversation that we just had now, including the notes that were taken on it, and integrate that. Including doing some smooshing of things together and trying to come up with a sense of urgency or prioritization that relates to the conversation that we just had and bring that back to the next meeting. So we're not going to take time now to go into the principles and outcomes document, but we're going to ask these two things to be integrated together into something that reflects the conversation we've had. Is that all right? Okay. So, Health Holmes.
Hi, everybody. My goal for this, that I'll just check in, is to give everybody a taste and an overview, but not try to make folks at Health Home experts here in the next little while. And so what I'm going to really do is go fast and end with some information that you can follow up on. Give us a chance maybe to dialogue a little bit about key policy questions, but I'm going to, if it's okay with the body, avoid getting into any mind-numbing detail. I've got a lot of slides here which you'll have to review, you know, over the weekend with your children. But I really want to give some of these folks a high-level overview. Is that okay? And go fast.
Yeah, I think the faster you go, the more we can talk, and people will want to talk about it a little bit, and I think that's good.
Okay. So, yeah, we can email. We can email the any of the data that's behind that.
So I think just, you know, we will post these presentations as we posted others. They may even be up already. They're up already.
So, the background on Health Home, sort of the take-home for me as I try to put it in my head with other things that have been happening in the healthcare and behavioral health spaces, that it was identified that patient-centered medical home is an evidence-based way to deliver primary medical care, has a lot of promise for behavioral health, but really sort of needs connections in order for it to work. And I think what SAMHSA and Congress and advocates diagnosed about patient-centered medical home was that it was missing a behavioral health hominess. And that behavioral health hominess needed to be added to patient-centered medical home in order to make it relevant for populations with mental health and substance use and some other kind of physical health care problem. And actually, sort of working in this space for a while, the CMS Medicaid Director letter, which we get a lot of these, this was, I think, one of the best-written and most on-targeted Medicaid Director letters that I've read in my career. It really sort of got it right about what was missing in the connection space between healthcare and behavioral healthcare. And I won't read it to you, but it basically says, let's supercharge patient-centered medical homes to make them behavioral health relevant, and let's supercharge behavioral healthcare to make them medically relevant. And in doing that, we'll put together something that, unfortunately, the law said was called Health Home, which confuses the crap out of everybody, but it's the term. And when you think Health Home, think of supercharged patient-centered medical home that has the right kinds of arms and legs to do behavioral health outreach and inreach, build it into medical care, build behavioral health outward and inward as well. So these are the provisions. I think the important ones are that it allows us to do a lot through a state plan amendment. We can waive state wideness and comparability through a state plan amendment, which we usually can't do. We usually have to pursue a waiver to do that. It allows us, you know, really to put together care management inside of an organized system of behavioral health and physical health care. And, by the way, spend 90 cents on the dollar of federal money in building this, which is, you know, and I've been saying to folks, is this is the crack that states respond to, is 90% FMAP. It's what we build out our sort of MMIS architecture against in the planning phases. It's what built the family planning program. When feds put 90% FFP out there, states generally tend to respond. So I think I've said a lot about what the intent and the purpose is, but the services are important. The services are really around care management and care coordination. And I think if you scratch CMS, I think long-term they would like to use health home rather than targeted case management as a vehicle for providing care management. I think they see strength in health home where there's weakness in targeted case management, and you all know those weaknesses better than I do. The beneficiary criteria are important as well. The lowest common denominator is that you have a chronic illness and you're at risk of a second. It'll also include folks with a single serious mental illness, and then anybody with pairs, triples, or more combinations of chronic illnesses. They're fairly broad in their chronic illness definitions, including obesity as one of the chronic illness designations. There's this confusing mix here on designated provider and team. We've really been choosing to sort of blend those two concepts together in the state guidance, and that we put them together with the expert panel with some of you guys were on. And but essentially you see most of our providers that we would certify either as an independent practitioner or as a member of a multidisciplinary team in a behavioral health clinic can and should participate in this, but there are some rules about how we designate those. A lot of flexibility in payment. Targeting is a little complicated. We chose not to overcomplicate it in our recent SPA submission and to target fairly broadly for our acute care behavioral health for the initial SPA. We drew the net pretty broadly, and we'll talk a little bit about this. Comparability is a federal thing, and, you know, we could get into that, but nah. Duals, this is carefully constructed language that there is no statutory flexibility to exclude duals, which I think means thou shalt serve duals or you will have been non-compliant with health home. That's a challenge when we talk about things like shared savings, because when we put a dual person in, we know immediately that what we're mainly going to be doing is saving the feds some money on inpatient admission. So those of you who have any federal contacts, we've been trying to, and this recent CMS letter goes a little bit toward this, but not all the way, around gain sharing with the states on duals would probably be important to, you know, getting to some of the principles John was talking about. We have to treat duals. We have to put them in. We'll look at the numbers in a minute. We have to do a consult with SAMHSA, which we did with OASIS and OMH. I think it went very well. They were pretty pleased with our early planning thus far. So we have to do an application. The application has to have all these things that are in here that you'll read about in the weekend. We're limited to 8 quarters for each SPA submission. So originally we had this thought about having this, you know, beautifully orchestrated population by population, geography by geography, 8 quarters, forget about it. We're going to kind of keep it simple, start it. Most of it will end after 8 quarters when we start. So why are we doing this? Basically, this is a story that, you know, we all know. We've been telling it in many different ways. This is just one lens. This looks at through a 3M software called Clinical Risk Groups, and it puts the whole Medicaid population, all 5.4 million people, in the critical risk group. The top is the healthy acute folks, about 3.6 million people, cost us 272 PMPM, and a lot of that is just plan premium money. Some of it, a lot of these healthy members are costing us on the downstream side, from to the plan, almost nothing a year. On the upside, the higher cost side, are pairs, triples, and HIV population. This lens didn't look at SMI. We'll look at that in a minute. And this is highly diluted because we're just looking at plan premium. We're not looking at downstream plan payment. But even with that high dilution, pairs, triples, and HIV are 18% of our member months and half of our spend, and you see some of those higher PMPMs there. Now we're just looking at the fee-for-service folks. This is 2009, by the way. We're looking at a million out of the 5 million people, and about 150,000 of them, a little less, we spent almost $7 billion on in 2009. If you look at some of the PMPMs on the far right, the triple 6,500 a month, basically $1 billion going out the door for 14,000 people. And again, that's just looking at the whole triple population. It's not looking at that quartile that's the sickest of the triple population. So
there's a savings opportunity. I think, again, many of you have been, if we orchestrate care in a better way, we're probably going to be savings. How much of this is about mental health and substance abuse? Well, we set out to find that out. So when Health Home came along, this is something that we just thought up as a theoretical model to begin to dive into the data, to think about it clinically in a way that we might sort of spring out with a clinical approach. So we put folks into, I've been cautioned by a member not to say buckets anymore, but we put these into groups. These are mutually hierarchical groups, so once you've got selected into one group, you're not going to show up in the next one on a person basis. So we started with developmental disabilities. That's its own system, primarily with its own response, but probably a big need to coordinate healthcare better. Long-term care, these are folks that had 120 more consecutive days in long-term care. We define what that means down below. Again, a group that probably has at least a geography in terms of where they are that would command a different approach. And then we got in the bottom two groups, which is what our first state plan submission was all about. This is the behavioral health group and then everybody else. And we're not saying this is a perfect theoretical construct, but it's just a way to approach it originally from a data perspective. And then for the purpose of complex, we define SMI, the pairs group, the triples, and HIV with CRGs as a rough way of going about the health home eligible population. So then when we...
say that last part again, please.
Sure.
Triples
so,
and the what?
So what the question, Harvey, in front of us was, what does our health home population look like? We defined it as these CRG groups, serious mental illness only, meaning you're not a pair or a triple. Pairs, triples, and then HIV. So that's our health home group, and then we put them into those four logic buckets. Probably should have explained it that way. So there's the populations, and here's the spending. 5,200 developmental disability folks that met the health home criteria, $6.5 billion. A lot of that, we've been reading about in the Poughkeepsie papers about what that spend is. Long-term care, $10.7 billion for 209,000 people. So, again, an opportunity savings here. And, again, this isn't everybody in long-term care. This is the people that are pairs, triples. We've got behavioral health in there. We've got some HIV in there. And again, 10% of Medicaid managed care on the developmental disabilities, 18% managed care and long-term care, but look at the duals. 50% duals for developmental disabilities, 77% duals long-term care. So we're in the Medicare space on those top two groups. Down below, now we're into sort of our acute care behavioral health group, $6.3 billion in spending, fewer duals, still a decent number, 16%, most of those on the mental health side, 61% in Medicaid managed care. So we're heavily into the Medicaid managed care space. We can't get out of Dodge without making it work right through the health plans. Same thing with the other chronic conditions. By the time we get to other chronic conditions, you're not developmentally disabled, you're not consuming the wrong long-term care, and you do not have a mental health or substance abuse claim, you're just sick. And that's $2.4 billion, 20% duals, and about 70% managed care.
So the criteria here for the mental health and substance abuse group is just a claim, or is it a threshold?
The criteria is the DRG criteria. So we use some pharmacy claims. We use diagnostic information, but it maps back pretty closely to service utilization.
So it's a modest to moderate level of service utilization puts you in that group.
Well, yes, or a diagnosis on an ED claim.
When you say pharmacy, you mean if I'm otherwise healthy but I'm taking Gaprolixin, I'm in that group?
You have to take it more. You have to have more than one script. The way the CRG grouping works is that it takes a look at some kind of permanence with regard to medication, and when you trip that permanence threshold, even if they got the diagnosis wrong, we know because you're taking this medicine for a while that you're in the behavioral and substance group. We didn't get it too much wrong, just the sniff test, the 400,000 folks. I mean, it's passing the sniff test that we're in the right ballpark.
That's about the same number as the individuals who receive any care in our system who might either have an SMI or an SED diagnosis, but we don't know if it's the same people. So, that's a sniff test kind of thing.
We'll look into it. And if anybody has, I was going to go one level deeper. Do you want to look, see if
I'll
that answers?
I'll wait to get those.
Okay, let's just look real quick. Because I think this gives us this. Now we're crosswalking the SMI group across the other category. So you see that our SMI, if you come across and you look across the SMI to behavioral substance abuse,
We've got about 104,000 folks that hit the CRG definition of serious mental illness, which I think was bipolar, schizophrenia, and major depressive disorder, I believe, for the most part. And then, so there's 104,000 people and like 6,000 that got snagged by the developmental disabilities or long-term care population. Now, that's, you have SMI, and that's all you have, okay? So you're not hypertensive. You don't have COPD. You don't have an addiction claim or diagnosis. So that's that 100,000. The rest of the mental illness is sprinkled through the PAERS, the triples, and the HIV, as is the substance abuse, okay? Because, again, we're capturing in here people with substance abuse disorder with diabetes. They're in. And there would be in the PAER bucket in that case. So if you kind of come across the totals, you see that we got $26 billion worth of expenditure, 2,300 PMPM, and you can sort of see how it breaks out, again, at the weekend at the pool. You can spend some time with this, but we really need to probably start drilling into assignment on these patients that are, and we'll look at this in a minute, less connected to ambulatory care, don't have a primary care doctor, not showing up for ambulatory mental health and substance use, but are still triggering these PAERS and triples. And then we'll look at some of that in a minute. I want to ask you a question now.
So because I'm sure that the vast population of SEB kids don't have diabetes or whatever, what's the criteria that you use for children?
So right now there's no straight SED only group here. So we could add the SED only in, and that's on our sort of open issues list right now. The only place that we'd be picking up SED kids is if they ended up in PAERS, triples, or HIV.
They're not likely.
So then this is an adult only model, right?
There's kids in here, it's mostly adults.
I think it's important to say that as a disclaimer, because I think we don't have any data now to know who's going into the health home.
But we will. And again,
I'm not being critical, but I just think we should just say that up front so then nobody expects that it's already defined, because it isn't.
Yeah. No, we've had discussions based on this conversation and others about the SED kids, and also about whether or not we do a specialized spa that looks at the diagnosis. We can't target by age, which gives us some trickiness here. But it's on the work plan. It's in, even though it's not in the numbers, and it's a great point.
Okay.
This health home model does work well for children too. So.
Absolutely. And we'll look in a minute at some of the connectivity issues, and then some of what we're thinking about in the model. Get your hands up.
When you say present Medicaid managed care, that's for anything, I assume.
Those are folks that
that would include people with serious mental illness who are SSI, who are partly in and partly out.
Absolutely.
Sort of any individual who is enrolled in
so
managed care.
That would
part.
Include people with health only and people
okay.
with full benefit. And that, there is a there's a metric there about continuous enrollment. I don't remember what the threshold is. 3 months or something.
Yeah.
I should remember that. And I don't.
For yeah. you, if you look year over year about people who are shifted, say, from the silly category over as a result of something that's undiagnosed and then tipping over?
Not in this analysis, but in previous work that I've been involved in, we see massive turnover from category to category, from year to year, especially when you look through the lens of cost. This is a little bit better because it's looking through a diagnostic lens rather than just a services lens. But our predictive modeling that we're trying to build right now would look at a CRG metric and then some of the other metrics that John Billings has found have been predictive of future inpatient, because we found quite a bit of regression to the mean and quite a bit of, circling back and forth between dollar-based utilization buckets. This will have a little bit more stability than a dollar-based one, but it still will be somewhat transient. Was that your question?
Well, I think so, but I also want to stress the serious mental illness-only category of individuals who go to the point and made and others have made. The fact that it may channel someone to focus on mental illness and not, and then ignoring physical health issues that may then...
Yeah, because of the rules in health homes, if you did that, we're going to bust your back on the rules, because you're really, this is all about paying attention to the whole person. So it gets you in the door in terms of eligibility, but once you get there, we're supposed to be doing a comprehensive care plan, which should include health and
no, I agree. I'm just saying it would be worth, if you want data to show that the individuals who are quote only may end up being...
Yeah. All kinds of things, because of medications and everything else. Right.
Because of the new technology. How does this relate to the information that we know, however robust it is, about outpatient clinic and the duration or the length of stay in clinic?
Why don't we keep going? I'm going to get at some of that.
Okay.
A little bit.
I'm just curious about whether or not those people who, by virtue of falling out of clinic or not filling a prescription, don't get included.
Again, we have not looked at that exactly through this lens, but we've looked at it through another lens, which I was just about to talk about.
Let me also just sort of say that we're getting in a number, you know, the health home is, at the end of the day, a quote-unquote chronic illness, you know, or planned care model for a population of people that's going to generally have well-established long-term conditions. So that's what it is. So it ain't a bunch of these other things. It ain't early intervention. It ain't, which is not to say that we shouldn't be addressing that point of integrated care early on, as we would with the patient-centered medical home, for example. But this, we're sort of in the deep end of the pool here.
So now I'm shifting off of the straight CRG, clinic risk group, diagnostic-based data, and I'm going into NYU, John Billings data on our chronic illness demonstration population. We ran a six-site demo that assigned patients based on being exempt and excluded from managed care that had high risk for future inpatient utilization into projects that were really designed to provide wraparound high-intensity care management. And this is a snapshot of those patients in New York City that had risk scores of future inpatient or 50 or greater in the Billings model, which meant that you were very, very likely to show up next year in inpatient based on looking backward at the last 3 years to predict for the fourth year, which would be the upcoming year, the year that we were assigning patients into. And the take-home message with this slide is that you can't do this work correctly without addressing mental health and substance abuse. So look at this, 73% of the patients that had that high risk profile, and again, these are exempt, excluded from managed care, so there's some sick folks, a lot of homelessness in here, a lot of other things, 73% of them substance abuse, about 66% of them mental illness. But that's not the end of the story. Then you come across that row. So, you know, remember that we're staring at, you know, three-quarters to two-thirds of the patients, and then you come across, and you're getting close to half of them are hypertensive, a quarter of them have diabetes, over a third of them have asthma, and a fifth of them have COPD. So what that says to me, I don't know what it says to you, is that our job is integrated care, and that probably where the service delivery system, in terms of the way we usually build it, is the most broken, is those connections between primary medicine and primary mental health and primary substance abuse care. And I think it continues to be reflected in our numbers. And again, you could do the quartile to quartile on this, and it just, the numbers just get bigger and bigger as you go up in the risk profile. And I don't know. At some point, these patients get really, really hard to treat, and we have to look at where you know there's an evidence-based impact. But this is, I think, where you guys are talking about glue, you know, the whole glue conversation. Well, I'd say right now we're not too sticky. You know, at least for this group, we need a little bit more stickiness.
Greg?
Yeah.
Is there any data about the savings from the chronic illness demo?
We're working on it now.
It's not available?
It's not available yet. It's coming soon to a theater near you.
Sure.
What's the relationship of the services that were required in the chronic illness demonstration project and what's in the proposed health home? Like, how much overlap is there?
Really, really close.
Really,
federal guidance was pretty close to what we required of the chronic illness demos. We had a lot of process stuff in the chronic illness demos.
chronic illness demos that we're trying to get out of the way.
Right.
What I think Health Home does is it focuses a little bit more on outcome, and we'll talk about that in a second. So I don't want to get lost in the data, but this is the last point. This is now this is a statewide snapshot, not just New York City, but the city story is similar to the upstate story here, and that is there's a good news, bad news thing. The good news is about half of these patients with this 50 or greater risk score of future inpatient are, by John Billings' definition, and we could argue about it, loyal to something, meaning they regularly return to the same place for primary care. And this is looking at evaluation and management services. It's not fully sensitive to behavioral health care. It's not ignoring it. It's just not specifically trying to pick it up. About a quarter of those to an OPD, 15% to DCC, and about 9% to or loyal-ish to a doctor. And you can see the number of providers that are touched on average. So they're still going to more than one provider, but they at least hit the loyalty algorithm for the previous 2 years. The bad news story is 20% of them almost, 19%, went to nothing in the last 2 years. So they're as sick as what we saw in that previous slide, and they went to no kind of ambulatory anything. And then 50% of them are shopping around their occasional users, or they're getting nothing. So what we're thinking about in our health home assignment is starting with that 51% and assigning that first both to the health plans and out in the fee-for-service health homes, that's our bogey, is that we have to focus on those folks that have little or no primary care connectivity, whether or not that's a plan-assigned PCP or not. If they're not showing up anywhere, it almost doesn't matter. We have to probably attack that first. At least that's early thing. And we're going to do it. Right now we're doing a loyalty sort of patient attribution analysis on that 975,000 patients I showed you, and I'll come back with that data. So this is very simplistic. It's a lot of colors. It looks complex. It's pretty simple. It says that, you know, if you meet the federal conditions, we'll put you in a health home. We'll assign you. We'll do an assessment. We want some kind of gradation with regard to response. What we did in CIDP and what a lot of the national stuff has done is you have a hammer, I have a nail. We put you in a high-intensity caseload. When you fall out of high-intensity care management, TCM has a similar problem. You fall out to nothing. We think there should be some kind of lower touch tracking type function here, some kind of moderate touch, and then something that wraps around a multidisciplinary team, peer support, all the rest, for the group that's at the highest need, that we have some kind of periodic reassessment so people can actually move up and down that continuum of intensity, and they can eventually graduate. And if they graduate and they need to come back, they can come back in at any one of the three levels based on their need, but they don't have to meet some high need 1 to 12 threshold when they come back in. And I got to say this, on savings, this is the issue. Because the issue with most of the studies of care management is the care management cost overwhelmed the inpatient savings when added to the specialty services that got added. So the only way to make this work, I think, from the numbers I've looked at, is to get that tracking function right and reduce the care management cost.
Really, what you're saying, that's an important sentence. The care management expense
paid all the savings from the almost most of the studies that we've looked at and looking at our own data on targeted case management, be that COBRA case management, mental health case management, is that they're all pretty successful at reducing inpatient, dramatically so for some populations, but that savings gets overwhelmed by the PMPMs we're paying on care management plus the ambulatory specialty services.
So it's important to put them in the right level of care management.
Absolutely, and to create something that's more of a tracking level care management so that we're not everybody's not getting 1 to 30, 1 to 12.
You're not over-serving people.
Absolutely.
Greg, I have a quick question, because I'm lost in this slide and the next one about when you say we're going to assign people, how does that in the real world, I'm the patient, how do I know I'm assigned? Who tells me? How does that work?
We'll definitely get there.
Excuse me, Greg. On the numbers that you were talking about with the case management, did that track over time, or was more the case management costs were front-loaded?
The stuff that we've been looking at recently is people that had zero case management in your beginning year had 12 months of case management in the next year. So you saw big drop in inpatient, overwhelmed by PMPMs for targeted case management and services that patients needed. And a lot of that, we hear anecdotally is, I can't let go of this patient because they fall out of care, they fall to almost nothing, right? So here I think the goal is you can get out of your sort of middle-level care into your lower-level care and stay in that tracking level so that when you end up in ED, when you end up in inpatient, you've got some kind of telephonic contact that's happening,
what you might not need to show up in the office each month for a contact so somebody can bill a rate code. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, I want to stay on the taste thing because I think we could kind of come back to this. I want to make sure that I get to the next thing. Is that right?
Yeah.
All right. So I think this is where this group engages. And you guys will correct me if I'm wrong. But and I've got another chart that says almost the same thing. It looks completely different. But and this is that this communicates two principles here. One is that the state's heavily invested in care management, whether that's through an MCO or a VHO. We've now set a path where patients are going to be assigned to something to provide some form of care management. And that what we don't, the mistake we think we would make here, early think, is to just contract around that whole thing. That to ignore the fact that a managed care company has a PCP assignment and works very hard very often to manage to that PCP assignment, we think would be a mistake. So the second, the middle and the bottom probably are sort of our, our favorite options here, which is that the MCO, the BHO, and the sort of patient-centered medical home, the health center, the community mental health program, the addiction program, together, taken as a whole, become the health home for the patient. So maybe the plan and the BHO become very good at running some of this telephonic stuff, and contracted down in the care delivery system is this middle-touch, high-touch care management, peer support, the whole nine yards. Maybe the MCO or the BHO actually staff the care management and purchase care management teams to install in primary medicine and install into behavioral health clinics. But we almost don't want the picture where the state just contracts down with an individual CBO or a hospital network around the plan, because that really subverts all the activity that we've put on PCP assignment, that we've tried to put on DHO, having some responsibility.
So that means the individual
attendance
provider won't be the health home, the MCO or the VHO will be the health home, and they will subcontract.
So we have, that's a great question. So we have right now, a million-ish people that are still in fee-for-service, 3.5 to 4 million now that are managed care and growing. And so the state will still need to directly assign some patients that are still in fee-for-service. We have patients that are in health-only plans that, a portion of the benefits is going to start to be managed by the VHO. The early think here is that, and holding aside the conversion of targeted case management for a second, which is on a couple of slides later, when we're looking at the 975,000 people that are not engaged in care management now, that those folks, if they're enrolled in a health plan, that we'd be working very closely with that health plan, and if necessary, the BHO, when that capacity comes up, to be delivering the health home services with the downstream providers. Now, this won't work, and we'll see it in our future slides, if the care management stays distant from service delivery. I mean, everybody's proven that. I mean, patient-centered medical home proved that care management, and we've proved it through our CIDPs, the further care management is from service delivery, and I'm not talking about post-discharge tracking, but actual face-to-face patient care management, the less successful it is. So the game here, I think, to get it right, is to figure out how to get the MCO, the BHO, and the actual certified health home service all working together in the name of care management. This next slide is just another way to say the same thing, but we're showing that there's health home teams down here that we're actually certifying against state standards. I'm just going to flash through the rest of my slides, and then we can get into
it. So if I'm a provider, I'll be on a team, but not a home.
The team resides within a health home. The health home has to have the correct composition of team as articulated by our standards under the federal guide. So our MRT target is to enroll people by October. We're actually on target to do that, I believe, as we sit today. We had a pretty broad expert group, mental health, addiction, HIV, plans, doctors, clinics, all sat with us on our provider qualifications. Those are now what we're calling interims. Qualifications are out on our website. We've shared them with CMS. They're available for folks to look at. We did our CMS and our SAMHSA consult. We have submitted our draft state plan amendment to state to CMS. That's also available on our website. The sort of the three legs of the stool that I've been talking about are finance, the provider standards, which we did, and our quality metrics. The provider standards are done very short. We just sent out our quality metrics and our, you know, drafty finance model to our expert group. That will come back. We'll tweak based on feedback. And then our final state plan amendment will go into CMS. We're also collecting CMS input during the middle of this. The Health Home website link is here, and we could link it off of the redesigned MRT website as well, so people can get right to that. And then, you know, our final issues are, you know, what are the roles of the health plans and the VHO? How do we actually change care management so that it's integrated into care rather than sitting outside of care? How do we leverage our health plan and VHO infrastructure, the data reporting, the provider networks? Our early quality measures, almost all of them, by the way, are stuff that we can collect with existing administrative data. They don't require, with the exception of our patient severity stuff, with our functional status stuff, which we'll likely add to this, they don't require the collection of new information. How we assign patients, how those algorithms work, we're working on, how we convert TCM programs. We've been working closely with Mike's team and with the AIDS Institute on that. Part of our financial model is shared savings, and we're talking about a little bit of shared risk, a little bit, against our quality metrics. And that's it.
The question about the patient flow, and is screening for the expert and screening for depression, is that seen as a standard part of all of the health homes? Or?
Well, again, what has to happen in a health home is that you have to do a comprehensive care management plan. So theoretically, if somebody came into care, let's call it John's health home, the screening would happen at the point of care, at the point of service delivery, either in the Article 28 or in the substance abuse or mental health clinic. But if that were missed, that would be identified as a gap in the care management plan. And some guys that are looking at building health homes are looking at building it around evidence-based. For instance, you know, Montefiore's been pretty articulate about taking depression screening and ESPRT and installing those in primary care as a central component of their health, of their sort of patient-centered medical home and health home that builds out from there.
So it's optional. People can either include it or not include it.
It's not optional as the care management plan, which would identify gaps, but the actual screening itself would happen during care delivery, most likely. I can't remember whose hands were next.
Let's go around the table.
The expert group doesn't have consumers or people of color, does it?
I don't remember, but probably.
Getting more room?
We can always make room.
Okay.
Are they still meeting?
Let's go around.
There was another question about are they still meeting. We sent the stuff out. We're getting feedback on that. We'll likely have a meeting on all three pieces with that group one more time. And again, I hope everybody appreciates we've been on a little bit of a sled ride here. It's pretty fast.
Let's step back and interject myself. Great to ask one thing, which is sort of, you know, we're here now. The notion is to, you know, sort of enrollment in October. So can you just tell us a bit about how the health homes are going to get assembled or designated? Sort of what your thoughts are about that over the next couple of months?
Sure. So, you know, there's a lot to say in a short period of time. Our goal is that we're not going to create a whole new certification category on an operating certificate with the regulation behind it. The goal is that we put up these provider standards, and I think one way to think about them is sort of a Centers for Excellence type designation where we've got those standards. We will send them out. We'll ask provider networks, we're hoping it's just not single providers, to come back attesting to each of those domains that are in those provider qualifications. That attestation document will formulate the basis of our approval for the health home. So it's kind of a fast-track Center of Excellence type model. What we're really looking for, and what I've been describing publicly, is the less meritorious and the more meritorious health home application. The less meritorious health home application is a single hospital network or a single CBO for a single health plan that says, I am a health home all by myself. The more meritorious health home application is a network of health plans, community-based organizations, and a couple of hospital networks that really sweep up a region and promise to work closely together to orchestrate care for a decent bolus of patients. What we're really looking for are, you know, a few robust regional networks that are reasonably well integrated. And we recognize that we have to get from where we are to there, and that may take some time, but we're going to be interested in assigning patients, and we're going to be asking our health plans to be interested in assigning patients in the most robust, most integrated networks that are most leveraging health information technology and ability to share data, ability to produce ambulatory slots, and ability to actually be mobile with regard to instantly providing as much care as possible to this high-cost, high-need group.
I have a quick question.
Going around the table here.
So you're saying that several plans will be in the health room? You see, am I allowed to? You see it a lot bigger than.
Yes.
You see it as a lot bigger than I may, some of us may have thought. So this will be huge, lots of lives, several plans.
We have
many providers, several hospitals.
We have about 975,000 patients. Somewhere shy, probably 50,000 of those are already engaged in care management and would likely be converted within the programs that they're in now. So, and one important thing to say is we've been working really closely with OMH and with the AIDS Institute on converting our existing targeted case management capacity, and we'd be doing the same thing with OASIS on MATS. Big mistake would be to rip patients out of existing functional care management. So we're really thinking that those providers that can meet health home criteria would come in, we'd be able to assign them new patients to the health home, but that they would keep their existing patients under their existing rates, whether or not you can meet health home criteria. So we're carefully trying to manage the transition from TCM now to 2 years later. The goal would be when BHOs are, you know, sort of up and we're looking at integrated care delivery, that we would have hopefully fully converted the TCM programs, but we give ourselves a couple of years to do that. But for the non-TCM programs, we'll do the assignment based on our algorithm, which will likely look at where patients are getting care and geography and factors like that.
So I'm giving up on going around because it's like two, you know, whatever. So do you, Gail, just...
do you contemplate having kids who have child welfare and juvenile justice involvement going into the health homes? And I ask for a specific reason. There are, if one of the issues is to control the cost of care coordination. If there already is a primary care planner, why would we create another care planner?
Yeah, and again, I think the answer is yes if they meet the health home criteria. Not all will, but some will. The easiest is the sort of the SED kids. But those kids that don't have the two or more or one chronic condition at risk of another, we won't be able to do this. So this won't, I think what I'm just trying to caution everybody on the kids side is it's not a population solution for kids for improving care management. It may be a vehicle by which we can create some structures that we could build out to do that, but we wouldn't be able to claim the 90%. We wouldn't be able to assign those kids.
Right.
But those kids that do meet the criteria, yes, I think what we would be asking is for some ability of a health home to assess that current function, you know, how functional are those current care management relationships? Should they be leveraged or should they be changed?
Right, but I'm just suggesting that for men, if the kids are in child welfare, they already have a primary care planner, case planner, with accountability to fix, and they have a goal that is not only about their health. They actually have to get to permanency, right? So if one of the issues is that care coordination is and care management is expensive because it's sort of sometimes over too much or it's not flexible enough, why would you, did you build an assumption about maybe saving some money there by figuring out a different kind of access for the case planner so that they can get to the healthcare service and save money?
Haven't even thought about it.
Okay.
So I would say this is a really good example for
right.
the kids group to, you know,
okay.
to get Paul.
Greg, if you could just tell us a little more, you mentioned briefly the BHOs and what the role of that will be when, as OASIS and OMH set them up, but how will that fit in? Will the BHOs be health homes or part of health homes? Will they be assigning people? Will they be paying for the services? What will their role be?
Honestly, Paul, I think some of that has to evolve, but here's the thought. You've got an SSI individual who's up on this chart that the state's going to be highly motivated to assign that individual into something. A person's enrolled in a plan for healthcare services, and now the BHO's got some responsibility to manage high-touch inpatient. So I think what we have to do at some point is bring these boats together so that, you know, let's assume that a network of providers in the Bronx comes together to deliver health home services, and we choose a regional BHO in the Bronx. At that point, I think that BHO has to be at the table with regard to patient assignment to the health home and who's doing what with regard to monitoring those inpatient services, for an example. So the way that I think this may end up playing out is that we come up with some kind of regional management superstructure between the health plans, the BHOs, and the health home providers to just think about health home services. But again, that work will be evolving.
So what about the patient or the member who's in a health plan now who meets the designation, right? So then does that health plan pay the health home for that member, and does that money get added to the health plan's premium from the state?
Basically, what you said is exactly
like
correct. Yes. So for targeted case management, what we're talking about right now is that the health plan would pay the amount that we've been paying in fee-for-service for that health home. For regular health home services, what we're talking about right now is a risk-adjusted PMPM. Yeah. That would go to the plan for whatever bolus of patients they got. And then they would be responsible for paying the downstream health home provider relative to whatever effort that health home provider did. And just to answer what might be some of the next questions. So if, you know, and I'm making a number up that's not what we're paying, but if we paid $100 and the plan delivered telephonic services and it was determined that that was 10 bucks out of the PMPM, and I'm making numbers up, okay?
And they're
you don't have to shake your head at the numbers. And that the downstream provider was delivering the $90 worth of high touch service, the plan would contract downstream for that $90. Or if the provider network delivered soup to nuts health home service, the plan would pay that price downstream. We're right now thinking we will likely set the price at the state level, tell the plan what to pay, add that amount to premium. But again, this is all early think.
So I'll just sort of say here, we are not going to get done with this conversation by the time we have to get done with it. So we're going to have to bleed this over into our next, you know, our next meeting, or sort of figure out some other way to do this. And I will say that the simultaneously all this stuff, you know, enrollment by, you know, around October 1, activities are going to continue. So there is a website and so on to go there and look at this stuff, and people can do that individually. But we're going to have to sort of figure out some way as a group to have a little bit more of a conversation about this at our next meeting, and, you know, whatever we go there. So that's a signal that a few more topics, and then we are going to have to move on. So let's say Phil and Kelly and Lori and Savage, and then we'll Sanjeev, then we'll move on.
So, you know, I have at least five questions written down, but I'm going to ask just one of them, which is, you talked about essentially the dismantling of targeted case management, and it transfers to something else, to the health home. How does that happen? Do we have a mechanism? Is OMH working on this? I need some detail that
sure
helps us understand.
I don't remember saying dismantling, but maybe I did.
You might have, you know, with
no, I think I said two things. One is, I said I think the feds are sort of signaling to us that health home is their preferred way of paying for care management. And I believe some of that is around the rehab rules and billing 15 minutes versus billing a month versus, you know, problems with overlap with clinic services and all the rest. So health home is a much more flexible vehicle to flow dollars down to a provider that's providing care management. And I think the feds realize that, and that's a very good thing. We get 90% federal money for it, so to the extent we bring in money there, we avoid a cut somewhere else in this environment. We're under, basically, we've been working with OMH on
this notion that there would be a two-year plan to get from where we're at now to where we're at in health home. And I think part of what providers that have been talking to us that deliver mental health case management are interested in is this flexibility, the ability to get out of the box on the rules for billing intensive and blended and trying to move patients back and forth, and the ability to maybe put up some kind of a tracking function here. So I think in general, the goal is to transition from targeted case management to health home care management, but to do it in such a way that we leverage the relationships that exist now in TCM rather than break them. And I don't think we should dismantle anything. I think the workforce that we need to make health home work lives in our targeted case management programs.
So let me try to say this, Greg, in a different way. This is sort of the my high level, which is to say not very informed understanding, so that we would try to move most, if not all, probably not all, but most targeted case management programs into a health home arrangement with the people they're taking care of.
That we do that in the short term.
Absolutely.
And in the long term, this is like, you know, when we've designed and we've moved into what we're going to do with a care management environment, that capacity is going to move into the, you know, sort of the BHO, and it's going to move at some level relatively intact with respect to capacity and resources. But we're expecting that in this interim period, as it's in the health home environment, there's going to be more flexibility, and a lot of stuff is going to have to be negotiated about who gets assigned and who moves from that caseload to the less intensive caseload, and none of that stuff has been worked out. So the notion is move it in, preserve the resource, and have available but changed as we come out the other side. That's my no.
So can I ask just a kind of question, because you earlier referred to an expert group that Harvey was commenting on. And is that a public group? Publicly known, that group? And are these the people who are going to be making decisions, or any of the folks from Power Systems going to be in that expert group?
Well, they are. There's people that you know and love on that group.
There's no secrecy.
It was small on purpose because it was bigger than we wanted it to be, but it was small on purpose because we're really looking to put together the draft patient standards, which was, by the way, I think we've gotten very good feedback on those draft patient standards from, you know, members that are represented by folks here. We really haven't had I haven't gotten any strong or medium negative comments on those standards. They closely follow the federal standards, and they borrowed from what I think was folks that were sort of early innovators in the field. We went fast. We went with a group that had done some work in the field. But we're calling them interim on purpose because it's a starter set. It gets us going. We can get feedback as we go. We can tweak as we go. The provider standards, we're hoping, don't get woven into the fabric of the state plan. They just become the state standards that we can change as we get going here.
So, Phil, anything else?
I'm going to leave.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Greg, when you're talking about, and this is how the health home is going to fit into the BHO, and you're looking at a few robust regional networks with plans and a regional superstructure, are you assuming that in a health home piece that region would be mirror the same region as the BHOs? And the reason I say that is, for example, in the Hudson River region, you go goes all the way up from Warren County to Westchester.
Yeah.
And so from the county level, there's a lot of variation in there. And then I'll just get this one other point out, and then I'll stop talking so you can. But in the regional management superstructure, too, I would obviously strongly recommend that counties are included in that as well when you were mentioning providers and plans and things like that. But how it's, you know, and from our standpoint, we're thinking in some of the rural areas, you know, where there are not, where the population might not be there, you know, where's the regional piece going to come together for a health home, and how do those people access those services?
First of all, I'd caution everybody, I was describing a continuum. I was describing a less meritorious or what we thought was a more meritorious application. I was not necessarily imagining that we were going to have the ability to, in each and every region, have three robust, you know, network. It's going to look like what it's going to look like when we get out of the door. But it is to our advantage, especially in areas with smaller populations, to put these patients together and try to give them to a network rather than try to farm them out to a bunch of individual providers. I mean, I think that just breaks the intent here. That's going to be harder for the health plans, harder for us in the fee-for-service program to manage a, you know, multiple flowers blooming. We really, so just trying to encourage the formation of regional networks when these applications come in. And we've been messaging that pretty consistently that the more networked you are, the better. But it is not a must kind of a thing. It's not identical to what's been done at BHO where we will have a regional entity. That we're not doing that. The data will inform some of this for us and for you, and we will get the data out by geography very shortly that will show where these patients live, which will tell us something about rural areas. It'll tell us something about suburban and urban.
All right. Lori and Sanjeev, and then I'm adding Ellen, and then we're going to move on.
Thank you. I have two unrelated comments or questions. In the case of what Mike talks a lot about, which are adverse childhood experiences, and the fact that in the ACEs framework, kids who have sexual abuse in their history or at present, or parents that are incarcerated, these are indicators of chronic conditions of the future. And so the question is, would these at-risk individuals qualify as being part of a health home because these are developing chronic conditions?
If they're obese, if they had diabetes and they were at risk of other things because of those factors, I think the answer is yes. If they have serious emotional disturbance as a result of that, the answer may be yes. If there's none of those kinds of things that are present, then the answer right now is no.
So let me come back to something, and you alluded to this before, and this gets into an arena, sort of not everything here is everything, and the health home isn't everything. So it seems to me that one of our tasks that we talked about before, and, you know, the point was made about, let's say, adolescents who are, you know, misusing substances, and right now that's the only dominant thing going on, and that could blossom into something else. So we need to do a better job of getting upstream on that. So we're going to be making some recommendations that call for the reengineering of what we refer to as primary care to begin to, you know, because that's got to change to lighten the load in the deep end. And I think that's Lori, a good example of that. So
the other is I'd like to make a statement, and that is that I can think of no resource that is more highly that is more important going forward, and obviously that's why the center prioritized care coordination as they have, than the targeted case management money across the state. And I feel like you've given us good information about what the early picture in your mind is of the possibilities around how to use the targeted case management money. But I, for one, would like to have a further discussion with you about that, and I feel that is part of the group, the work here at the table. I have concerns. I have concerns about how we track that money over time as it gets blended or not with MCOs and other structures, and whether or not there's a pass-through of that money or it's off the top. It's an incredible resource, and it, I think, deserves its own topic.
So let me sort of take that as a comment, Lori. Let me sort of go where I'm thinking about this, because there's more, you know, sort of energy, and there's also way too much dissonance and diversity in our comments right now for us to bring this to our.
And I'd like to add math to that as
well,
because I think
okay. So what I think we're going to have to do is sort of end this conversation in just a second. We have two more people in line, and then we'll try to think about how to structure a more focused conversation about this in this group at our next meeting, and we'll so that more work is going to be done and more is going to be evolved by then. But we'll spend a little bit of time on this, and we'll try to think of some way to have a more structured and focused conversation and be able to then reflect that back to Greg. He'll be here for that. Sanjeev.
The patient-centered medical home began with standards, policies and procedures, NCQA, designations, level one, level two, level three, pass-through of dollars, down to sites who had to do more than put things onto paper, but put it into practice.
And we've had, you know, hundreds of thousands of people enrolled in patient-centered medical homes. And we're still waiting to see the outcomes of those efforts. But the money is already flowing and has been flowing to those efforts. Those outcomes could be geared to QAR scores or HEDIS scores. I have not seen any correlation yet with those efforts, despite them being around for some time. I was at a level three medical home this morning, a site, and, you know, looking at their QAR scores over 2 years, not seeing much improvement, with the medical director saying, you know, part of it was making sure the money that came in actually got allocated to what the medical home was supposed to deliver on, and fighting for it at the administrative level to get make sure that that happens. So I think there is, you know, the level of oversight that that's going to require, and I believe, as I understand it, NCQA audits around 5% of the sites for medical homes to actually see what's happening in practice. The other piece, and this is that sort of the level of, at the higher level, at the patient level, we've had an experience with designated aid centers, which are also supposed to provide cohesive case management services focused on case management for the patients with mental illness, substance use, as well as HIV, often as the real focus of what the aid center was supposed to deliver. And we've seen a great variety in how the premiums were, the seven-tier rates were being paid out, but a great variety in how actually that care was being delivered. And I've worked in a number of the designated aid centers and seen the great difference in how that model is actually applied, but we've had it. We're paying out resources. So I'm just trying to establish here, in doing this, and it's been done rapidly, and you're starting October 1, and it's going to, quote, evolve. How are you going to ensure that the outcomes and the structure and the audit function is going to be robust?
It's a great question. Another thing I think that CMS got right here is that even in their SPA preprint, it's all about outcome measures. And there, if you go to the website, grab the SPA down, you'll see our draft measures by domain. And the two key measures that you have to include, and we would have anyway, are avoidable ER and inpatient and then readmissions. But the whole program, and the reason we're doing attestation, not certification, is really about measuring these objectives. And long-term, really, I think we should be thinking about patient assignment based on the achievement of those performance objectives. And we've been on purpose trying to stay away from process and stay more focused on outcome on this one. We really don't know what we'll find at the end of the day. I think some of this is evidence-based, and most of it is a guess that when we glue these things together, that one of the reasons why some of those QAR needles may not be moving is because we haven't glued together the mental health and substance abuse correctly for the patient-centered medical homes. True, false, don't know, but I think this time we'll learn.
Until recently, you could be a level 3 patient-centered medical home and not do anything about depression. You know, so that's which is part of the reason why there were no good outcomes. But just kidding. But you're. I don't know whether your point is skeptical or inquisitive, but it's a really significant point. And Greg's answer is good. The truth of the matter is, though, that the feds put this thing out with a 90-10 match, and that's a freaking club, you know. And so we. At a point in time when the state is facing its worst challenges ever, plus we know this care, and Greg's data illustrates that, this care is broken, you know. So it's sort of a word to the wise or a word from the wise about what is going to have to happen to, this is going to be pretty sloppy when it gets started, and it's going to have to be assembled over time. So, again, Ellen, you get the last word, and then we'll try to figure out how to have a more focused conversation about this next time we get together.
I'll host it at my office any old time.
And one thing I just want to add before we go with this, and we have a savings target, which is going to be publicly measured. So.
What is it?
I don't remember.
Ellen, go ahead.
Great. One of the things I wanted to ask you was the choice involved in being involved in a health home. Talking about assignment enrollment, what is there and what is the level of choice that individuals have for that?
Great question. And I'm assuming you're talking about patient choice,
mm-hmm.
not device
mm-hmm.
So we cannot, what we can do under the state plan amendment, and we're planning to do, is we can assign patients on an opt-out basis. So we can send a letter to Mike and say, Mike, you know, we've determined that your, you know, service access seems to indicate that you might be in need of health home services. Therefore, we've assigned you to this health home that comes from the state. It'll come from the plan. And it may have some sentence about, and if you, you know, don't like this, you can get out. But the plan is that we would also add a term and condition to our 1115 waiver to allow us to make this a mandatory program.
This is down the road a little bit. This is more like along the timelines that we're planning for.
It is. But one of the things I'll just say that we learned about our CIDP is retention is excellent. Engagement is very difficult. And every program nationally that we've been doing learning collaborative work with, we found this, that once you get somebody in, they stick really well. But engagement is tough. And so having the ability to do some kind of a mandatory focus here for this population is pretty good. And I'll just say this, that, you know, we're staring at 60 to 70% managed care penetration with a mandatory selection and auto assignment, and yet we still get worried about, you know, a mandatory assignment of patients into something like this. So I think we've already crossed the Rubicon that we're afraid of, and we probably should go there faster rather than slower, because our CIDP experience showed that this is our biggest barrier, frankly, to care. That being said, we do have a little work to do to get that 1115 amendment done. But once we make that 1115 amendment, then we can make an assignment on a mandatory basis. The state law requires us to offer choice where practicable. So any big urban area, there'd be more than one health home that patients would be allowed to choose from.
Just let me, two more points. Where is the pros in related to this, or is it?
The pros in terms of the
program, the program, and
the pros program.
The pros.
Pros. She runs the pros. Again, so
and
pros,
the new,
and OMH can answer this as well, but pros is like any other, I mean, in my view, and you guys can answer, it's like any other community-based resource to the health home to begin to leverage to help people avoid inpatient,
okay,
ED, and the rest. And I think, you know, it might be a nice one-stop shopping for those programs that are working.
And then the last thing I wanted to ask you, is there any incentives, peer services, or other peers on the expert group? Those are two questions.
I have to check back about who was on the expert group, but we've woven peer throughout this in several different places, and I think Harvey nicely highlighted that in a note he sent out. And it's baked into our thinking, and we think this doesn't work as well without peers. What we found in our chronic illness demos is outreach into the community without peers doesn't work.
Thank you.
So here's what we're going to have to do. We just sort of like, you know, opened this up. And thanks, Greg, for doing that and giving us for some structure. We're going to have to do two things. One is we'll try to figure out some way to have a more focused and structured conversation about this at our next meeting. And you're only going to be able to participate in that if you've been to the website and read the stuff. So we'll have somebody with a hook, and anybody who makes a comment evidencing that they haven't read the stuff that's on the website, they'll be yanked out with the hook. So we, you know, two part thing, and we have to try to figure out how to have a structured conversation. So we'll take that one on. But you know, thanks for the overview, and we'll talk more the next time. So now just doing a triage here. We have half an hour for an hour and 15 minutes worth of conversation. It's actually not that bad because I think the wrap up we had half an hour for, and we don't really need that. But we'll try to sort of take a deep breath and move on. And again, so Eileen, you're up. We can sort of figure out if your stuff is on here. And what we had wanted to try to do was to have a presentation from the managed care world about the, what I described before as the managed care 101, so what Eileen has described as principles and practices of managed care. So you're going to run us through this pretty quickly. Do you want me to just click?
Yeah. I'll go very quickly. In our last discussion, last meeting, I was struck by we all come from different perspectives and different worlds, and the world
live in, at least now, is the managed care world, and I, that's just all the discussion. I thought we needed to sort of connect the dots a little bit, so I'm going to go through this real quick. Basic, I apologize, but I thought if we won't start with the same place, we should get there. So the first slide, definition. clearly, and I've health insurance characterized by network of providers with a defined population and a fixed payment. We'll come back to fixed payment is one of the key elements here, if you think about this globally. Managed care places special emphasis on appropriate use of ambulatory and inpatient settings, evidence-based decision-making, cost-effective diagnosis and treatment, population-based planning, and that's very, very important as we talk about behavioral and health promotion and disease prevention. I mean, managed care has really changed. It's much more about wellness. It's much more about prevention. It's much more about education than it used to be. And government and employers, it's really different sides of the same coin. They want to have a predictable amount that they're going to spend on health care, also with the best quality and the broadest access. And, again, predictable. It's about having a prepayment number so that government knows what it will be spending rather than in the fee-for-service world where you're just reimbursed. So we talk a lot about risk, and I hear providers often talking about assuming risk, and I thought it was important to understand, as I've learned, the depth of what it means to take risk. And so you'll pardon me, this is sort of our actuary trying to speak English to us, but financial risk is defined as an unexpected, unfavorable financial outcome. So you're taking risk for things that might happen from a financial point of view that are bad. Companies accept risk, obviously, in exchange for premium. And then the real problems come about when the event, the care, costs more than the expected or projected cost. So what do companies do? And, again, this gets to us providers learn about this. When cost exceeds expectations, we have to hold money in reserve to cover the variation, and we are required by the state law to have a substantial amount of money. It's a percentage of premiums, and we have to keep that money available to essentially underwrite the risk. We have to keep, a very important point here, we have to keep track of financial results on an incurred rather than a paid basis. That means if someone's in the hospital, that's when you talk about incurred, but the IBNRs, you have someone in the hospital, you haven't paid the claim, you haven't received the claim, but you need to count that against your capitation. Very important. And then another way we learn about accepting risk is to spread the risk over a larger population. The larger the population, the more likely you're going to have a normal curve, the more likely you're going to, at the end of the year, come out being solvent. Very important principle. We also purchase reinsurance. The other things we do about once we're at risk is we reduce the variation of cost by controlling, by contracting, by getting good deals with providers, essentially. And then also plans seek to avoid adverse selection. So one of the things you want to do is if you're a plan in a market, you don't want to offer, like, all the cancer care that other plans don't. You want to be sort of be with the market. Otherwise, the six people will choose your plan over others. So then I just thought the Commonwealth Fund, I always like the kind of stuff they do, their view of the success factors. You need a strong physician health plan partnership. We're really away from the old, you know, Mayotte School of Managed Care. I mean, I think we've evolved, the system's evolved. So those partnerships really need to be very robust, and we've got to do it together, not in an adversarial way. We provide information to physicians to support their practice. Because we deal with a large population of people, we look at evidence, outcomes, evidence-based medicine, we can contribute to the physician, practices. We provide docs with quality and cost data, and we believe you need to have a local orientation. You've got to be in that community, not on high someplace. So we talked about payment models, and obviously the most basic that we've talked a lot about is the fee-for-service. It's clearly paid retrospectively, not prospectively. Remember I said the importance of a prospective, pre-arranged amount of money. So fee-for-service is retrospective. Of course, we all know it encourages, it's incentive, and we talk a lot about incentives, and we will be doing more of that, but it encourages utilization, and it lacks the incentive to be efficient at to keep people healthy. And that's not to say it's never right. I understand the point you made. I thought that was a really helpful point. One of the ways managed care plans mitigate the expense of fee-for-service are by utilization review and clinical management, various quality assurance measures, and the state does this also, and they hold us accountable for some of those outcomes. We provide a contracting methods, and, of course, you use a network. And the important thing about a network is you need just the right size network. You need a big enough network to attract members, but you need a small enough network to be able to target utilization. If you have too large a network, you don't have enough leverage to get better deals in terms of the cost, the unit cost. I know I don't have to say this to this group, but I'd like to remind everybody more care isn't always better. In fact, sometimes with tests and hospitalization, more care is really worse. Global capitation free or full risk, I already defined that before, essentially. We do have, for example, global capitation arrangements with provider systems. So then in my plan, we have a global capitation arrangement with Montefiore. Montefiore is unique. It's probably one of two places in the entire state that has the full infrastructure to develop, to pay claims. They have a managed care infrastructure. There's no other provider in New York City that really has that. Maybe the corporation, I'm not really sure. So we do. Now we keep a little bit of that money for those services that we're required to do, the reporting to the department, certain insurance, legal, but basically the full capitation mostly goes to Montefiore.
In which case they're at risk.
In which case they're at risk, and that's right. At the end, yes, but I think the interesting question is if they go under, who ends up paying the piper? It's probably us, but I'm not sure. I'd have to look. So the plan, and Greg would probably know more about the requirements, you can never really get totally away from the obligation if you're a plan, you're a licensed plan. You can't offload everything. All right, you can go to the next slide. So obviously, this is more, we can skip this. It's really that if global capitations are adjusted, you have a formula. I don't need to go into that. But the last bullet there is important. In another world, when I was in the behavioral world, we used to do these provider plan arrangements, and the way we looked at it is you draw a page with all the functions, and then you have two columns, providers and plan, and who does what in those arrangements varies depending upon the arrangement, the incentives. So there's no exact right way, but there are clearly certain functions, the larger functions, the kind of functions that require a lot of investment, having a claims engine, having adjudication. There are certain kinds of things that most of the time, not all of the time, but most of the time those tend to be the plan functions, whereas other functions go to the providers. So then we also do partial capitation or professional-only capitation. So it's obviously similar to the global, but it's much narrower. So we have, again, as an example, arrangements with medical groups where they are capitated and essentially at risk, not insurance risk, but they're at risk for professional services, you know, outpatient visits, not for inpatient hospital. As I understand it, in the 90s, ICMs were capitated and other mental health services were fee for service. So there's been a history of, you know, having arrangements that are not full of risk arrangements. And then the Medicare Community Nursing Pilot, where nurse case managers receive capitated payments, again, just for medical costs. And it's something, as we get into our issues, we need to look at what are the incentives and ways we can pay providers that are not risk, but that incentivize efficiency and promoting of health. Also, we have single capitation arrangements, some of the ones providers don't like or members don't like, unfortunately. But, you know, laboratory, radiology, physical therapy. So there are other entities where we contract, they are at risk, and then they manage those services for us. Case rates, one that I'm sometimes interested in, we also can be called a bundled payment, where you have a single payment for an episode of care or for a treatment. You can read the examples there. One example is, you know, prenatal care through from the beginning to labor and delivery. You can have one payment to that doc for that. And we do some things like that, and that if you have enough patients, you know, has a positive impact. You don't get into every single visit, and if it's priced right, it's an effective way of managing cost and care. DRGs is really, and you all know what DRGs are, but it's based on hospitals. But it's really a case rate. It's another way of looking at it. Instead of paying for every day, you're paying for diagnostic-related group, an episode of care in a hospital. That incentive is for the hospital to keep the – to basically manage within the payment, and there's no incentive to keep somebody. You know, I think we all know of circumstances. You go to the hospital on a Friday, and they don't have a lot of docs around, so you end up still being there on Monday, and they're getting paid every day. These are a couple of examples that I got, and Richard Sciola, as you know, wasn't going to be here today, but Value Options has a program in Texas, which is a partial risk, again, where they're basically in the behavioral sphere paying a partial capitation for certain services that the providers have. The block grant in Kansas is interesting. This is not risk. This is not subcapitation. It's basically saying, and I've read a number of examples of this, it's basically saying to a provider, you have X dollars to serve this person. The dollars stay in the plan's bank, not in the provider's bank. It's not a payment. You now can then draw down these dollars, and there's also another example that you sent out, Harvey, with a patient-centered approach to this, but the financing is the same, so that the provider and or the member themselves can buy certain services, or in the provider's case, provide certain services. They have to. There's accountability. They just can't go spend the money, but that and that's capped. So if you know your exposure is $10,000, you know, you figure out a budget and then you draw down the money. It's like a debit card. That's a good In some cases, I think they may actually use it. Something like a debit card. Yes. Other payment incentives, and this is something obviously we deal with all the time with the Department of Health and with our QARs and HEDIS scores, but it's the whole idea of pay for performance, financial incentives for positive outcomes, patient safety, efficiency. There are various structural indicators such as investment and use of health information technology, but again, it's all about incentives. It's all about paying for things that are positive. And then incentives are funded through a variety of mechanisms, including withholding a portion. You can have a holdback, and you can pay 90%, and then the last 10% the provider only gets if they hit certain thresholds or certain pre-agreed-upon quality measures. You can also hold back and then add as a kicker. And then you can also share some savings. We talked a lot about, you know, reinvestment. There could be some approaches there where there's shared savings. This is the example, I believe, that came from Harvey. Help me if I'm wrong, Harvey. This is Texas. But, again, this is one where individuals are making their own purchases. It's a very exciting, and it's something that Lord knows we're not ready to do here. But down the road, as it's developed, and I just don't think we're there yet. Well, okay. I don't think we have a payment system yet. I'm not saying consumers can't do it. And the exciting thing about this kind of thing, if we could get the approval from CMS, is that it's what capitation has allowed in other states in the behavioral area, most familiar with Colorado, where you can actually, by using a capitation model that's at the plan level, the plan is free to reimburse or to pay for non-traditional services that are not typically in your Medicaid list of services. But that requires a waiver, right? So then the next slide is everything we do, and I'm just going to talk about a couple of real quick examples. I'm watching the time. Some of the things we do, just to give you a flavor, and then you all can think about how it may relate, you know, to the behavioral world. But it's all about data. Everything is about measurement, data. I mean, we live for data. So you need a large population, and even if we have small demos, there is a database that the health department and OMH has. It's an old truism that a small number of consumers use most of the healthcare resources. We and all plans implement strategies to deal with what we learn from that data, and that's around comorbidities, the whole range of programs. We have a long, long list of specialized, intensive and not so intensive case management, coaching, educational programs to deal with the various diseases, complex case management, and then point of care. And I'm going to talk about what that is in a moment. So let's leave that slide. Yeah. So go back one if you would. So two examples I want to give you real quick about some stuff that we've done. And again, it has implications as we think about behavioral. So even though it's not behavioral, I want to just share them with you. In my plan, 2% of our members use 50% of our dollars. think about 2%, 50. Most of the time you hear 50, 5%, maybe 40%. 2% account for 50% of our care dollars. So we started a intensive selective part, and I don't want to mean targeted the way we talked about it here, but a specialized case management program to deal with those members, depending upon who they are, what their illnesses are, you know, what made sense for them. And just in a rolling 12-month period, the trend on medical costs before the case management intervention was 13%, going up 13% on that rolling 12-month basis. After we instituted the case management program, it was 2.4%. So that if you put the resources and the care in terms of this whole discussion about care coordination, you know, where the action is, you can make a very big difference. And those differences are based on getting more timely care, avoiding inpatient care. They're not about denying care at all. And then the second point I'd make, and somebody talked about, I think you did, Mike, about the importance of about getting the case management, you know, into where the patients are. So we had something called the point of care program. What we decided to do is we took nurses, pharmacists, case managers, social workers, I think that was the four, and instead of having them on the phone in our building, we sent them out to a medical group. So they're right there with the practitioners offering the care. And so we looked at a population of people who were coming out of the hospital, who went to see their doctor, but who had a whole variety of needs, getting a script filled, getting medical equipment, getting an appointment with another specialist. And so our people were there doing that right in the place. And in just, I think, 3 months, the rehospitalization rate went down from 17 or 18% to 10. So we took 7 or 8% off our rehospitalization rate just by responding more quickly. And also having that human contact. Now, you can't do that everywhere, but as we have and you talk about health homes, as we have larger and larger concentrations of our members in certain high-need communities, this is clearly a strategy to work with them, the members, and their physicians to get them the care they need more quickly and most importantly, to avoid rehospitalization, which is in most cases when you haven't given someone the right care, it's a failure. Rehospitalization is a failure. And then lastly, and this is just to sum it up, managed care, I've said this before, is about access, price, and quality. And those three legs of the stool are the key. If your price is too low to providers, you might end up not having access. You need to balance those three. You need to have sufficient network, but at the right price, and that drives the right quality. And we use all these payment methods as well as programs, and they're pretty high touch programs to meet those goals. That was really fast. I'm taking
really
a breath now.
So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to jump into what I hope is equally quick. So the same thing with respect to some of what's been learned in the behavioral health arena with a focus on mental health. Just as a complement to what Eileen has been through. So this really just tries to take, the first principle is what I've said here. So everything that Eileen has said applies, and then there are a few special things that we have to think about as well. So this is the first slide here is the list of problems, and then I'm going to go to some of the things that have been done. And, you know, this is probably not quite as elegant as what Eileen has done, but I just sort of threw this together based on what I think we've seen around the country in the last 15 years. So one paradox is that most behavioral health care is not provided in behavioral health care. Most behavioral health care, I shouldn't even call it behavioral health care, most people with behavioral health issues are quote-unquote seen in primary care, but their issues, their behavioral health issues may not be seen. So just like two examples of that, your chances of being detected with depression in primary care is about 50-50. And the other, the kid's example is ADHD, so that, this is like the one-liner is 50% of the kids on stimulants don't have ADHD, and 50% of the kids on ADHD aren't on stimulants. So this is the first paradox. Now, we're sort of in the deep end of the pool, but the shallow end of the pool is of consequence.
the stigma of seeking behavioral health care is a second. So we have the first thing here is the care levels of care are suppressed by a failure to detect and act in primary care, and a second failure is that people make rational decisions to not get care because of the stigma that will come with seeking it. Hell of a no. But, you know, we know that's true. We have several other examples that are more provider-specific. We have a distinct set of providers. Once you get past primary care, that sort of like, you know, those of you in the provider community, different set of organizations that are primarily, you know, and this is a reflective of the history of the field, you know, sort of separate organizations that deliver addiction services or mental health services or both, and some of that is integrated, but most of it isn't. And then we also have this little phenomenon that's been long known, that outpatient care, specifically psychotherapy, is more price-sensitive than primary care, and it's price-sensitive at both ends of the spectrum. If you make it too cheap, people will use too much of it, and if you pay a little bit too much, or pay a little bit not quite enough, it'll disappear. So it's more price-sensitive than going to a GP. People will tend to go to a GP if they're sick, but they won't necessarily, you know, price will make a big difference in whether or not they go see a therapist.
Mike, can I just ask on this one, is your point the price to the consumer or the price to pay to the provider?
Turns out. Now, so I'll just give, you know, sort of an anecdote. I was in Ohio, and overnight, half of the medical staff at one of our hospitals disappeared. Half of the medical staff disappeared. What had happened is that the Ohio State employees' behavioral health plan had just been flipped over from a very generous indemnity fee-for-service program into managed care. And it turned out that these docs, you have to understand Ohio, this is Cincinnati, was the only place that psychoanalysis is still provided. We had a bunch of docs working half-time at the state hospital. Half-time was what you had to do to qualify for the state employee benefit to pay for their analysis, which was all being paid for in the fee-for-service program. As soon as this was managed, they left our employment.
But Mike, with mental health parity and Timothy's law, federal and state, we can't charge. You have to have the same copay for behavioral now.
Yes.
At least from the member, that could be too high for a member.
And it raises the question of if you have the same copay but the price response is different, what are the consequences of that? This is one of those things that hasn't really kicked in yet. But parity and also the ACA changed these dynamics somewhat. Up a little bit. Prevention, targeted prevention, is now really relevant. We have this IOM report from 2 years ago, but we don't do much of it. Big challenge for us. And this other problem, mental health conditions can specifically impair health seeking. So this is a double, you know, jeopardy. If you're depressed, you may not go get help precisely because you're depressed at some level. So we need workarounds for that. And then that because we've had, for complicated reasons, because we've had no insurance for these conditions in a separate public system, we haven't had a viable marketplace for mental health care in the insurance arena. And we're now talking about putting all this into management. So what are the consequences of that? And then this other dimension that we talked a lot about before, non-health services or Medicaid services can be crucial to health outcomes. So people get employed, and people who are in the mental health system get employed, they go to work instead of going to day treatment, and we save money on mental health costs. So how do we think about that one? So now just a couple thoughts with respect to each of those points. So this is I'm on the first point. People are seen in primary care but are not treated. There's lots of evidence about this, including the evidence from ESPER. And this is my one-liner. I'm not, I'm sure if you all in the addictions field would agree, but just paying for ESPER wasn't enough.
Was not enough.
Not enough. Yeah. Right. So it's a payment. It was a payment problem, but it's more than a payment problem. We generally now, sort of know that this model of collaborative care works. And collaborative care is a term of art. You might describe it as co-location. So, putting the psych nurse or a social worker in the medical practice, but it's more than co-location because you have to have screening. You've got to have data and measurement. You've got to have data points. You've got to measure stuff. You've got to adjust care based on the measurement, and you've got to train the practice that you're in so people know how to work together as a team. So it's not just co-location. It's like sort of effective co-location. It's effective. They're now, what, Lloyd, like 40 randomized controlled trials using collaborative care in different conditions, but it's by and large not done, which is the reason why we don't have detection, we don't have treatment. So the question is New York State ready to step up and take steps toward toward doing this? And I think of this as a two-way street, because you might also say that collaborative care ought to be the approach by which we pull medical care into behavioral health settings. So the second, I linked these two problems together. Stigma is a barrier, and then psychotherapy is price sensitive. So reducing barriers to entry and access is a really significant problem. And I'll just offer one example of that. In the commercial arena, we've seen this. There are some plans where you have an EAP, and then you've got the behavioral health plan. You get a few visits of EAP on the house. There's no copay. You know, you just go straight there. And the idea is that two or three sessions is everybody ought to use it, because it's a good way to solve problems or head off significant issues. If you need more, then you go through the plan. That's one example of a workaround to increase access. We also know that cultural competence is unusually important because of the stigma and the barrier that already exists. So it's more important with respect to behavioral health conditions. Oh, I talked about that. Increasing behavioral health capacity in primary care, or making primary care behavioral health informed, is another workaround. Network adequacy becomes a little more complicated when you've got, for example, these issues of cultural competence, you know, different communities within a borough in the city. And then sort of here's another example of this. Because of the price sensitivity thing the way that most specialty plans or mainstream plans that are well managing the behavioral health benefit don't apply UM to psychotherapy. So, because what you want is to have everybody who needs it get it. But then what you do, and it's not worth it to try to manage it. So what the plans tend to do is work with and credential providers who tend to have efficient practice patterns, and that they get good feedback on, you refer people to them, and you let it be worked out, you know, in and of itself. That tends to be the way that psychotherapy is handled. So then we have this problem, and we're in the transition place about this, because we still have the reality. We have a legacy system with most specialty services provided by a distinct set of providers. So in the past, this was one rationale for a carve-out. So hire a firm that can work with those guys. But this situation is changing rapidly. So this is my assertion, or you know, my presumption, that it seems to be as a core part of what we're dealing with. As long as you have equivalent standards in place, it makes less difference who does it. So we have different approaches that we're supposed to think about: the special needs plan arrangement, the carve-out arrangement, or the integrated delivery system arrangement. Any one of those might work if we have the right criteria for it. And I jumped ahead here. So the issue about targeted prevention, we've already talked a lot about that. I'll just give this example. I used this in the previous meeting. So this was a spin-out study that was done in the STAR-D study. The STAR-D study was a real-world study of the effectiveness of depression treatment. And one of the spin-off studies that was done is moms who were getting care for clinical depression in the STAR-D study, workups were done of their kids. 86% of the kids of depressed moms had a diagnosable mental illness if they were seen by a professional. The depression treatment resolved 50% of those problems. Nothing was done with the child. Just treating the depressed mom reduced 50% of the morbidity of, if you can call it that, of the kids. So this one is complicated. Lots of stuff to talk about. It's been worked through our conversation, and I want to propose how we get into this a little bit more. So that because of these problems in help seeking, you know, sort of we got to do a better job with respect to access in New York State. If the rate of depression in the TANF population is 40%, 5% penetration is not gonna, you know, not gonna fly anymore. And then when we are dealing with these issues, outreach and engagement are particularly crucial. Interestingly, it's the common sense things that make the most difference. So a welcoming environment, you know, one of the reasons why collaborative care is so effective is that if somebody comes in, they do a screen in the waiting room, they're being seen by their doc. If the doc can just say, let me ask, you know, Mrs. Smith to come down and join us for a few minutes. Mrs. Smith is a nurse care manager or the social worker, and then they can go into a conversation. That first appointment has already taken place. That's not going to be missed. And the third of the, you know, the drop-off that we have between referral and first appointment is taken care of because you have a warm handoff. So open scheduling and shared decision-making, if people have, you know, skin in the game, they're much more likely to play. We have to reach out to people when folks won't come in. This was talked a lot about in the first meeting. Peer outreach and wellness, Greg talked about that with respect to the CIDP. I've learned from my experience that peer-operated alternatives have got to be considered a core part of a system of care. They're not going to become the majority part, but they've got to be an option because that's the only place that some people will go in the front door. And then, you know, sort of the system, this is a tension here. We want to move to a less, quote-unquote, coercive or, you know, sort of high-end stuff, but the system has a responsibility for public safety. So how do we balance that? We have to do more at the top of the slide here and less on the bottom, but we've got to do both. As colleague Tom Fox, who's a medical director in New Hampshire, used to say, the way to achieve liberty for the many is to do good risk management for the few. It's an interesting, you know, an interesting paradox. So we've got to think about how to better balance this array of issues.
That's, you don't mean, Mike, that the few is a state or city policy where we, in some cases, we're not doing it for the few. In some cases, we're not, I mean, you say we have to protect the freedom of many by allowing leveraging for the few, but we have policies in the state and the city where it's not just for the few, it's
for the many.
It's the primary policy.
Well, right. You know, so, right. So, as I said, we've got to get a better balance here. And one of the untested theories, but I think we sort of believe it, is that if we do a better job of welcoming and outreach and engagement and those things, we'll need to use less of the other. But that we haven't tested that yet. So then this is this other point that I point out about market failure. So the marketplace for behavioral health insurance hasn't sort of worked in the past for multiple reasons. Including a lack of parity. So if you went beyond $5,000 in a year or so many sessions, whatever, you're out of plan all of a sudden. Well, that's not so very good. But it's also the flip side of that is the fact that we've had a specialty system operated by the state has meant that you didn't really need to have insurance because if you got hit catastrophically, there was someplace else to go. And so this worked both ways. So one of the things that's tough for us is we're about to create or change the safety net into this managed safety net. So as we do that, what are some of the approaches that we're going to have to take? One of the things that generally there are lots of different payment mechanisms, and Eileen has focused on this at two levels. The plan accepts the risk, and there are multiple steps to manage the risk, and then uses different payment mechanisms for providers. I'm referring here to the level between the payer and the plan. So because of these different dynamics, one of the things that's tended to happen in the mental health world is that there's been a sort of 90% of what is intended to be spent, the plan is at risk for, and it's out there for services, and the plan is at risk if it spends too much or if it spends too little. And then there's a fee paid for management with incentives for good performance. And that's because under some other arrangements early on in the managed care game, if the whole thing was just capitated, it was easy to drive down utilization too high, you know, sort of make a one-year profit, move on to somewhere else, and the network has been thinned out. So that's just one example of an arrangement. And we've also got to figure out some of these things. You know, how do we handle the possibility of multiple plans or arrangements within the city? You know, so how do people not, how do we avoid adverse selection or people getting dropped between the cracks? And then we've got these other issues to think through. You know, what about the state hospitals? Do they continue to be a free good if you can get into them but nobody can get into them? Or do we want to create some incentives for appropriate utilization? Where does that fit here? Probably not year one, to go back to what Eileen said, but that's a lot of money there. The non-Medicaid stuff, we've talked a lot about that. So how are we going to think about all those non-Medicaid, you know, services? Does it all get dumped into plans? Does it get controlled by LGUs, and there's some kind of a, you know, creative tension between the plan and the LGU where each depends on the other? Can we figure out how that might work? So there you have, you know, sort of a 101 and a 201, if you will. So let's just, we're already past our time, but let's take a little bit of time for questions, conversations about these last two things in particular, and then we'll try to move into how we work with all this. So John and then Andy. And then.
I guess I have a thought about, two things. One is the addendum to the conversation about managed care was really almost exclusively focused on mental health.
But yeah, I try to make that clear. I don't, because I don't understand the addictions world quite so much. So
right,
some of it is comparable and some of it isn't.
Right, right. And some of it's actually like very, very different. You know, so like just for instance the prevention piece, you know, we talk about the use of primary prevention and targeted prevention. There's an expertise in that substance use disorder field that I think is, you know, very, very strong. But I guess I'm very concerned about the imbalance in the conversation, and that kind of leads me, as I try to fast forward to our next meeting and the meeting and after, I'm starting to think about, okay, so what's the product that we're going to be producing and what's going to look like, and what is the relationship between what we're talking about and what the product's going to be. And it, you know, today's meeting was very, very helpful. I think it was some very good discussion. However, it feels to me like a lot of the trains have left the station. And I'm having a hard time imagining, like, what exactly is it that we're going to be proposing and discussing, which may have some influence over where we go. And not the least of which was the earliest discussion about, you know, the underlying premise. You know, are we about trying to save significant dollars and strengthening our systems, or are we going to sort of cannibalize our systems a little bit and give back some savings and then be forced into a depleted situation where we're now trying to do a Herculean task, you know, without the infrastructure and a whole bunch of other concerns. So, you know, simply put, I'm concerned that I'm hopeful that at our next meeting, it'll be a little bit clearer exactly what it is that we are going to be able to sort of concretely recommend. And I'm just thinking now, you know, there's a lot of chemical dependent service providers. If I were to say to them, Let me tell you where we are or where we're headed. I'm not so sure that I could really. No, I'm certain that I can't answer that question. So I think in terms of planning the next agenda, if we can think a little bit about balance and you know where, you know, how much of this can we influence and really sort of start honing in on those areas. And if there's some areas that have already been decided, let's say that okay, they've been decided and you know. We're not going to go back there. There's no going back. You know,
sorry, but our time is up. but, you know, I'm sort of glad you said that because this is the stuff that's on, in one way or another, sort of on everybody's, you know, everybody's mind. It's going to be what it's going to be. You know, we have to co-create it. We'll have some thoughts about the next meeting. But and if anyone wants to bring in, as we think about, you know, the next couple meetings, you know, suggestions to assist with that, I think that'd be helpful. So,
yeah. Great points, and thanks for the presentation. I thought they were great. I think in related to this question of where we sort of where this group's work can sort of fit in, where we can really make a difference. I do think we need to get a little clearer about kind of levels of intervention and kind of influence. At the end of the day, what we all want is improved outcomes for patients, cheaper, you know, and it may be a pipe dream, but we still are at a place where we think that that's possible to do this dose at the same time, that there's enough sort of, there's enough misallocation of services that may be possible. So we're still in this sort of hopeful phase. Part of what we're all saying and part of your presentation, I think, Mike, was about there's still just a lack of evidence-based practice out there, you know, that there's still sort of like there's stuff that's happening at the clinical level that isn't the best. And you know, there's an inadequacy of screening in primary care, potentially an inadequate sort of emphasis on the physical health care of managing other kinds of physical chronic conditions and behavioral health care. There's stuff that's happening at the clinical level, and then there's sort of the design at the system level that needs to be oriented towards incentivizing the right stuff at the clinical level and at the, you know, and resulting in good outcomes. So I think it is, because the goal all heads to the same place, better outcomes, reduce cost. It's easy to sort of conflate the two things of like what is better clinical treatment and what are the sort of system policies that we can put in to hopefully address those. But I do think we need to be in our group sort of clearer about where the interventions are and how to sort of separate those which are at the clinical level and those that are at the system level.
Mike, I'm never clear, and I liked Eileen's example about the point of care program that you talked about. And I'm always a little fuzzy on what we can pay for at the front end. And I know in the fee-for-service we're still in our silos, but there's some things that we know probably going to work, and notwithstanding health homes and what they might bring to the table, there are things, like you mentioned, mobile teams. We've talked about getting in-reach and outreach, and certainly that's a great example with the point of care program. So I kind of keep thinking, is this within our payment rubric, or because it's outside of our licensing silo, so to speak? So when we down the road, when we're in managed care, I think we want to get the savings and have the good outcomes at the early stage, not to lose the money. In other words, I know you talked about a waiver. I think it was Greg who brought up an 1115 waiver, maybe down the line where we can use Medicaid more flexibly. But you kind of worry, like, if we don't do some of this at the front end, we're not going to see better outcomes for people. We're not going to see savings. So I kind of really don't know, like, how much of these licensing silos and service silos, again, I was saying the new health home model, can we get out of, and how much can managed care pay for? You mentioned capitation insurance level, but you need a waiver. So I kind of wonder, like, how do we start this thing if we're still stuck in some of our silos and we actually can't do some of the work that we know needs to be done to really have good outcomes and engage people?
Can we come back to that one, I think, a little bit, yeah. Laura?
I'm wondering, in terms of the scope of the work that we do at this table, I feel as if there's lots of discussion about the ways in which providers and even stakeholders will have to want to change. One of the discussions we didn't have here today with the discussion overall of managed care is the ways in which the state or you in your own capacities police yourselves around certain indicators that, to my knowledge, over the last few years, just looking at Medicaid managed care programs and trying to influence policy around rates for them, I discovered that there aren't very many indicators at all in terms of, you know, basic expectations that the commercial side has, the insurance world has, the SID has for commercial-based insurance plans. You may disagree.
Well, the health department, I mean, HMO licensure,
right.
The health department,
right.
DOH
and,
yeah.
And commercial. And I discovered, I think, that in all cases, the amount of indicators as successes of, as indicators of performance and success are few.
I wouldn't say that.
No, we have very robust measures
on the behavioral health side.
Well, there are measures that we're talking about today
is managed care in the context of behavioral health.
Is treatment after hospitalization, antidepressants,
and ADHD.
There are a number of them, but the population we're
those
talking
are the three
about
measures
about
that are
right.
Up,
so,
eight, seven,
so
eight,
my
seven,
point.
Eight.
So my point.
The heat is measured.
Yeah, the heat is
sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
I give up.
Okay,
so we're agreeing with you.
So my point is that this is uncharted territory to a certain extent, and the chart that I've seen so far is lacking. So we talked a lot about managed care today, but we didn't talk about performance of plans, and we didn't talk about expectations. And I'm just saying that I think that that's fair game for this conversation.
Yep, absolutely. So who's up?
Yeah, I still feel that I think we have to come back to that basic definition, behavioral health. I mean, behavioral health is not just mental health, which is what it's coming out to be at some of these discussions. And I think we need to include the substance use disorder population group. We do have expertise that will be able to come forward and at least identify some of the, you know, services and treatment modalities that we're talking about. And I think we need to have that at the table. We really need to have, I guess the next step will be to have a true discussion of managed care of behavioral health services. And define what that is. And certainly we have enough expertise that could talk to us about race settings and so on and so forth. Up to this point, I don't think we've done that. And, you know, I would be more than glad to work with you and Linda to present something. But I think we need to start rolling the ball, and we haven't done that. And I think for the next meeting, we need to put that on the table.
I'd welcome that. Yep.
Well, one way that might work would be to hear about what the experience is, not in New York State, but in other parts of the country around managed care and the relationship to substance care services, in the same way that we have been learning a little bit about the mental health side.
So let me sort of try to go into a sort of an on-the-run summary of some of the things that we might want to do in the next meeting. Now, this list that I'm about to do is longer than is going to be possible to be done, but it's sort of a candidate issues that that we might want to do about. And I think, you know, I'm going to have to we'll have to think about this, see what your feedback is, taking our advisement with Linda, Arlene, talk to you, and just sort of see what we do at the next time. But sort of here's what we've got. Here's what I've got on my list, you know, so far. And I want to say before I start this that the list is going to be too long to be done in the next meeting, and it's not going to include some things that people want to get done. But we're going to have to start managing our time. So this is some of the stuff that I'm hearing about. We do want to hear from Gail on a sort of a plan and a prospectus, in a sense, for proceeding with looking at kids. And sort of a part of this is that we're assuming that that approach is going to have to be inclusive of prevention, and it's going to have to be inclusive of addiction issues and as well as mental health. But that's implicit in what I've said. So we definitely want to hear where you're at in that effort. Who's the group? What's the mission? What's the plan? Where do you hope to get to?
And my kids was young kids through somebody, I think, qualifies it up to young adults, that kind of thing.
I don't have an age in mind, but you know, so the kids until they're adults, and that includes families.
Good.
As has been said. So that's one topic. Obviously, we're going to have to spend some time working on the sort of the products of what we've got so far. So the staff are going to have to work some magic with the conversation we had before, with the notes that were taken, with the products of the prioritizing exercise. And to some extent, I'm seeing this as a significant part of the first chapter of what we end up producing. But so we're going to hope to see a first draft of what we've got so far with respect to principles and priorities. I guess that's what I would describe. I think partly picking up, Arlene, on what you were saying, that it may be possible and it may be appropriate, those are both mays, I don't know, to get into a little bit how is this being approached across the behavioral health arena in other states. The city has a working relationship with the Center for Healthcare Strategies, which is probably the sort of leading group that is focused on these issues, and it may be, you know, it may be possible and it may be appropriate to have them come in and do a little bit of a brain dump of what they're seeing in other states, which are beginning to get us a little bit out of the ethereal, a little bit more grounded. So that's another possibility. We've said that we want to dig into the health home.
home stuff a little bit more. So what we're going to try to do there is try to think through some way to have a work session that is going to assume that everybody has gone to school on the stuff that's on the website, has digested Greg's presentation. And this is, so this is going to be a little bit more like, you know, I think action recommendations with respect to health home. So we have to think about how to do that.
What percentage of people who are in VHOs are going to be in health homes?
We don't know the answer to that question.
73.5, I think.
73.5.
So,
sure. You know, the health homes, you know, so here's the deal. The health homes enrollment, you know, starts in like 4 months. The interim BHOs are not plans. The interim BHOs are, you know, so the interim BHOs are going to have to collaborate with the health homes in some fashion, but I can't say anything other than that, or the lawyers will come, you know, take me out of the room because we're in a procurement period for that. But then the period that we're really designing for, which is, you know, April 2013, you know, everybody's going to be in some kind of a plan arrangement, and many of those same people are going to be in health homes. We don't know which yet.
So it's some percentage. It's actually less than 73. But if you look at that, we have 408,000 or something cases in that behavioral health bucket, expanded a little for those with DD and long-term care. Those that touch inpatients would be candidates for behavioral, for a BHO.
The interim BHO.
Yeah.
Right.
The interim BHO. So right away, some portion of the 450,000 that are going to touch inpatient in a meaningful way should likely have some kind of touch on the BHO on the interim basis. But then downstream, is I think what Mike is saying, is that 400,000 plus everybody else that's not currently being managed should be managed by whatever we're building here, right?
Okay, so we're getting into conversation, which conversation is good, but our session is over. So we have to pay for it. There are two other things that I want to, you know, mention for the next meeting as possibilities. So one of those, I don't know whether it's possible, but the, you know, that Linda had said at the first meeting, it'd be nice if we had somebody from budget here and we could talk about this kind of stuff. The reality is, because we can't have that conversation until we get there. On the other hand, it may be possible for us to have a little bit of a preliminary frame with respect to understandings about, you know, finance. And I think it might be helpful to try to at least have a first blush, you know, to throw off something about, you know, that some parameters to think about. So, like, you know, first year, second year, third year, without getting too concrete, you know, what are the different circles of hell with respect to financing and feasibility, just so we can zone in a little bit on what might be realistic for us to take on here. And that might be, that's not a conversation that can be finished until we get all done, but that's one thought. And then the final thought for me is that it comes back to what, Laura, you brought up, and that is maybe it's time to begin thinking about measures. So, you know, this, and measures gets really into the weeds, but maybe we ought to sort of, you know, have a first cut or a first presentation on, you know, sort of a, you know, what would the state agencies recommend vis-a-vis measures, and that might be another topic. So, as I've said, that's a bigger list than we can do at the next meeting.
The TCM is in the health home stuff,
TCM,
right?
TCM is in the health home stuff.
Embedded.
It's embedded, that's right.
And in the BHO later. But first it'll be in the health home, and then it'll be in the BHO. So sort of take a deep breath.
Enter your nose.
Do that all your stress. And then sort of what, is there anything else for the good of the order before we move on? I don't know. I guess, you know, come back to Arlene. You know, question for you is whether you might want to, you know, confer with the city people about whether there's anything else related to the addiction stuff that you want to bring forward that CHCS might be able to represent or not. So I'll just, you know, leave that to you.
And I think we probably do want to get that brain dump from them. Whether we can get that at the next meeting or the meeting after is going to be primarily a scheduling thing. Anything else then before
we? Kind of, they can probably touch a little bit on your number five about finance at the federal level at the very least. What's been done?
Right.
Doing a CHS.
CHCS. Yeah.
CHCS. Center for Health Care.
Not Steve Summers at all. What is the meaning of silence in the group?
It means there's been no break for this entire meeting.
It means that was sort of the time to go. Thanks,
you know,
everybody.
I hate to leave in a way because I sort of feel like I'm almost ready to do something.
Yes.
But I don't know exactly what that is.
Yeah.
Well, you know what you have to do. So you,
mine,
you gotta,
yeah, I do.
You've got to do a whole project.
No wonder I feel that way.
Right.
You have your assignment.
Thanks, everybody.
The leader has disconnected. The conference will be terminated in 2 minutes. The leader has disconnected. The conference will now end.